It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. What a great show we have for you. Tim Stevens is here from CNET, Clayton Morris from Fox and Friends, my old friend Dan Patterson from Tech Republic, and we've got some deep, heavy topics to discuss. Who's winning the AI race? Can Facebook really tell you how to reach depressed teenagers? And robots roaming the streets of Dubai? It's all coming up next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT This Week in Tech, episode 616, recorded Sunday, May 28th, 2017. That's not a hot dog. This Week in Tech is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job boards, including social networks, all with a single-click screen rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter free at ZipRecruiter.com/TWiT. And by Bowl and Branch. For a good night's sleep, try their ultra-soft, 100% organic cotton sheet sets. Get $50 off your first set of Bowl and Branch sheets and free shipping by visiting bowlandbranch.com and enter the offer code TWIT. And by Rocket Mortgage, by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/twit2. And by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. See what's on the menu this week and get three meals free with your first purchase and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the latest tech news with a panel of inspiring, brilliant tech journalists. Starting to my left with Dan Patterson. When is the last time you've been in studio? Ages.
I have never been in studio, but been on the show since 08 or 09.
And you never bothered to come to visit us?
It's heartbreaking when I come back to Sonoma County because I just want to stay
here. You're from
here.
Yeah.
My heart and soul is in Sonoma County.
We first started talking to you when you were at CBS Radio.
ABC.
ABC.
I'm at CBS now.
Yeah, so very good.
Yeah,
ABC, we're doing some great reporting. At one point, you covered, I thought it was very interesting, you used Storify to cover Occupy Wall Street.
I did, yeah.
You've covered the presidential campaign.
Three of them.
There been that many? Feels like I only remember one now.
They're all fake, though. All of these campaigns.
It's all fake campaigns. I'm starting to wonder. He's currently a senior writer at Tech Republic, our friend Jason Heiner's place, part of CBS Interactive.
Boss.
Is he your boss?
Jason's my boss. He's a great boss.
Gotta be a great boss. A sweetheart.
If you think of drama, we are the anti-drama.
Yeah.
Tech Republic is just good people doing good work.
Yeah. I really like that. Yeah.
And CNET. Friends.
Got a tip of the hat to CNET. That's where our good friend Tim Stevens hangs his hat with Roadshow, theroadshow.com, where I think he does some of the best automotive journalism out there. He's also a racer.
Thank you very much.
He races on ice. He's an ice racer.
Really?
Yeah. You've heard of ice road truckers?
Of course.
He's an ice road racer.
Tim, I learn things about you all the time.
Oh, there's so much more to learn too, man. We should just keep along these lines. Yes, yeah, but not racing so much this time of year, but on the asphalt more now. The ice is gone, sadly, for now.
And we waited until the Indy 500 was over before we made you show up here.
So appreciate that.
Timed that very carefully. Also here, a good friend, haven't seen you in a while, Clayton Morris from Fox and Friends and his company, MorrisInvest.com. Hi, Clayton.
Hey, guys. Great to see you. Thanks
nice
for having me back.
Nice to see you. Close personal friend of Donald J. Trump. No.
But the next, opposite would probably
you will do
be
me,
true.
You would do me a favor the next time he's on. Will you wear the Wookiee mask? Yeah. I think it'd be interesting to see the reaction.
I don't think he likes me much. I mean, I do.
Has he ever tweeted you about you?
No. But I do ask. You know, I always ask the tough questions of the people that from his staff that are on our show, and I'm not afraid to ask those questions. So, but I don't think he's when other people are fawning over him. I'm not, and I'm just asked the straight question.
Yeah. He does live tweet Fox and Friends. Has he ever live tweeted you?
Oh, he's definitely live tweeted things that literally we've just said, or commented on stories that clearly no one else was covering, and he was watching.
He's
and
watching. That must be a little intimidating to know that the president is in there in the residence watching you.
Well, it's true. And, you know, this morning we had on a group of veterans who were riding to D.C. For the, I think, the Thunder, forgive me for
I know what you're butchering talking about.
All the motorcyclists, maybe, Tim, you might even know, there's like 96,000 of them come to descend on Rolling Thunder. Some come from Australia.
I was going to say Thunderdome, actually. It feels like that's where we're going lately.
The Rolling Thunder Run. It's like the Sturgis Run, but it's but it's to D.C.
To honor those forgotten POWs. I mean, there's tens of thousands that have gone missing, that are forgotten. And anyway, we had the founder of it on this morning, and I knew that the president was watching after his 9-day trip to the Mideast. And, you know, they're frustrated with the government spending thousands on the defense budget, but not spending any money to find these soldiers and really trying to find and do as much as they can to get these folks back from these foreign wars or identify grave sites, et cetera. And I said, if you had a message to the president, we know the president's probably watching right now. Do you have anything to say? He says, President Trump, we'd like to meet with you. We want to, take. So that's a powerful, mechanism. He was frustrated. He's frustrated with this administration. He was frustrated with the last administration.
Talk about a bully pulpit.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's a crazy time. I mean, don't get me wrong.
Now your schedule's changed a little bit. When are you on Fox and Friends now?
So I do the weekend show. So Saturday and Sunday, I'll be on tomorrow morning, Memorial Day. 6 to 9 a.m. and I'm on Wednesday. So I fill in during the weekday, but Saturday, Sunday is the weekend anchor of Fox and Friends. So
nice.
The number one show in the world.
What?
The number one show in all of cable news. And morning show in all of cable news.
Wait a minute. Like even better than in your time slot or you mean in general?
In our cable news. Yeah, in our time slot.
In your time slot. Nice.
Yeah.
I was going to say, if you're number one in general, that's... Wow.
No, sometimes we beat, we go up against the Today Show because they're broadcast. Nice. But we neck and neck with those guys sometimes.
That's really a big deal. Yeah.
It's crazy.
So here's a top story just come in. The Steve Jobs hype is over. According to ZDNet, they auctioned off yet another rare Apple One. I don't know if this was Mitch Waite's. We had Mitch Waite on the show. He had a Apple One looked just like this. It was an auction in Cologne, and there are only 8 working Model Ones, Apple Ones out there. The guy who bought it, $130,000. That's all. They sold, remember, for $666 back in 1976 or 77. But the reason the guy was disappointed, this seller was disappointed. One had sold for $905,000. Another one sold last year for $815,000. I think it's a little much to say that the Steve Jobs hype is over, however.
It's a great headline.
That's a great headline.
Got me to click. Got me to click. A German engineer bought it, $130,000, but it did include the cassette player.
How many are there?
8 working. There are many more not working. It's hard. So Mitch Waite, who was some of you remember is from the Waite Group publisher, he's now famous because he's done some really nice, believe it or not, bird watching apps for iOS. But he has an Apple One that he got ages ago, and he got a friend and they worked on it and they got it working. We did a triangulation. You can go back and watch. It was a working Apple One, but it was non-trivial to get it working again. Because these things really kind of have corroded over the years. But I think Mitch will be disappointed because I'm sure he thought he was going to make a pretty penny off of that.
I love the idea that Jobs hype is over, though. I mean, this really,
Is it? Is it over? No. Is it really over? In fact, Steve's greatest accomplishments opening now, Apple Park.
Right.
The brand new campus. That was his last. I mean, it's actually very sad when you look at the video of Steve presenting Apple Park at the Cupertino City Council because he was really on death's door.
Right.
It's almost open now. In fact, let me show you. Remember all those drone videos? Matthew Roberts, one of the drone videos, has made a time lapse of the construction of Apple Park, which took several years. He's got it down into 1 minute and 5 seconds. The spaceship campus. starting March 2016. Why do they always have this music on these?
Didn't they have some trouble with the glass?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe you heard me talk about that because I thought I had a scoop. I probably should have written it up for some important journal like Tech Republic. But we had an engineer in. He said, you know, I'm working on the Apple campus. I said, oh, really? He said, yeah. And I said, oh, how's it going? He said, well, it's settling. I said, what? He said, it's settling. I said, anytime you build a building, he said, it settles, right? The problem is these panes of glass are massive and they were breaking. And he said, and you know, the real problem is they're expensive. They're like $100,000 each, and you can't just make one. You have to make them in big batches. So they make $1 million one of these at a time. So if one breaks, you got to make $1 million worth of glass windows. I guess it stopped settling, though. It's done. It's done because they're moving in. In fact, I talked to an Apple employee who was in the studio visiting us Saturday. And I said, you get to be in Apple Park? He said, yep. I said, when are you moving in? He said, later this year.
Yeah, they're doing that batches, right? Like 500 at a time, 300
First
at
people
a time.
Who've gone in are the ones who are setting it up, pretty much.
You know? The important ones.
Yeah. But he's an engineer. He's the guy who he works on the human interface devices on the iPhone. And he gets to be in there.
And you guys don't, with all that glass, you guys don't have like any earthquakes in California, which is pretty good.
That's
never
a relief.
Never.
That's a relief. Yeah. No tornadoes, no earthquakes, no acts of God of any kind.
But it is. Isn't it on like 4-foot springs or some insane?
Oh, yeah. It's an earthquake. Actually, yeah, it is an earthquake-proof building. And nowadays when they build buildings, there's one building in San Francisco that's actually falling over. But normally,
just one.
Normally, when they build them on big rollers so the building can move. And I'm sure that they've done that with the spaceship campus.
I mean, joking aside, like Apple Park is. I do hope that this is the last kind of Jobsian effort that we see, this little push up the hill. Well, and I hope this allows Apple to kind of move into an era that is defined by their successes and failures as well.
I kind of just wish they'd spend more, a little less time on that and more time on the laptops. That's just my
thinking. Yeah, right. That's precisely what I mean. Like, I would like to enter into an era with Apple where we can say, oops, we kind of messed this one up.
Well, they did. They said that. The Mac Pro.
After a couple months of people bitching about it.
A couple months? I bought it three years ago, and they never updated it.
Touche.
I actually had it as it was a doorstop for a while, literally.
I think you are seeing quite a shift, though. I mean, wouldn't you guys agree more to a more open, at least, more open Apple? You're hearing from executives doing, you know, Phil Schiller just did an interview the other day. Jimmy Iovine in that music publication just did an interview. But you're right. They still have a long way to go if they're going to move completely in that direction. I also think it's not a terrible, you know, they're also, I think, drilling down or doubling down on secrecy. So we don't know a lot of what to expect at WWDC. You remember past keynotes
where
everything was detailed. I mean, we knew everything, and it kind of took the shine off of we don't know much about anything, I think, for WWDC.
That's a good point. I never really thought about that. Mark Gurman of Bloomberg did say that WWDC, they will announce new laptops, some upgrades for their, you know what, I don't mean new in the sense that the design will change in the least, but they will have KB-Lake laptops, yeah.
But I think this was an intentional leak to kind of stop those drip, drip, drip of negative press about how bad this current crop of laptops is.
I almost feel like now when you see Tim Cook and Phil Schiller giving interviews, when you see leaks like this, that it's all part of an Apple campaign to dampen expectations, to set an agenda. Tim Cook has now several times said, we're doing augmented reality. You would never have heard Steve Jobs say
that. Right.
But what does that mean? I mean, you've got people like Robert Scoble. He's been on this show saying, oh, it is a negative. At the end of the year, you're going to be amazed. And I'm thinking, no, I'm not.
Yes, but that's Robert.
No, I'm not. I'm not going to be amazed.
Take showers with Google glasses. I love Robert, but you know.
Oh, no, he's an enthusiast. Right. Look, you can't knock him because he's an enthusiast. And I love Robert, too. He's an old friend. And I'm not knocking him, but I don't complete. We have a bet. I said, if he says the next iPhone, I swear to God, he said the next iPhone will be clear.
Right.
You said, what, the one in the fall will be clear? He said, yes. I said, if it's clear, I'm taking you to dinner at your favorite restaurant. He says, it's in Paris. I said, fine. So I hope it's not clear.
Does he just mean no bezel? I mean, because I think we
that's
know
not that's clear. Right. We know it won't. Right. It'll be, you know, an OLED screen. Probably it'll probably be like the S8 and the LG G6. It won't have much of a frame, no bezel. But that's going to be the state of the standard, I think, in smartphones
for a long time, and for Apple as well. I think like the era of the next big thing, like the surprise Apple, is long gone. I think they want to try to delight users in their language, but I really think that we will see predictable incremental upgrades from Apple for a very long time.
How much of that is Apple, and how much of that is the industry?
It's the industry, and the
we're really there. We're
at
peak smartphone,
right? And it's not like, I mean, IoT is coming, but it's way more of a business thing. It's not like consumers are going to get hyped up about their next wearable thing.
Here's another thing Tim Cook's been hyping. I think. He mentioned it at a in Cologne, in Scotland or Glasgow, at a university talk. He said, "Yeah, I've been wearing. I just took it off, a Apple Watch that tells me my blood, continually monitors my blood sugar." Yeah. He mentioned it again, but if you read Rachel Becker's article in The Verge, no one has ever done a needleless blood sugar monitor, at least none that's still on the market. It's a very difficult thing to do. Sure, it's a big market. 30 million Americans have diabetes and would want this, because right now, I have type 2 diabetes. We have to prick our fingers several times a day, draw blood. It's painful and it's annoying. If Apple, and it may not be Apple. Tim didn't say we're doing it, but he just said it's on my watch. Probably be in the band. If they have a non-intrusive a blood glucose monitor, that would be huge.
It could be really huge, yeah. And there have been plenty of others who've tried, though, and nobody else has been able to do this. In fact, it's almost like, you know, a perpetual motion machine that a lot of companies have said they can do it, but none have actually managed to do this in a reliable, yeah, repeatable way.
It's the cold fusion of public health.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Well, and having the idea of being able to take off different bands and be able to put them on the watch that interact with the watch, right? Isn't there the lightning connector inside, yeah, on the backside of the watch as well, which kind of hidden
it's
down in
hidden
there?
It's a hidden one, yeah. Nobody's ever developed anything to do it with it, right? It's just Apple uses it as a diagnostic.
Right, Apple uses it for diagnostics, mm-hmm, and other things, but to be able to use the bands that are specific instead of just having, you know, like a Nike Sport style, there might be a special glucose monitor that you could
would be
wear.
Amazing. I would buy, yeah, it. I think every diabetic would buy it. Google, remember, working on a glucose monitoring contact lens. But according, right, to Rachel's article, by the way, no one has said anything on this in the last couple of years. According to Rachel's article, it's really hard to do. I did not realize this. But there's only about a sugar packet's worth of glucose in your blood at any given time. She quotes Mark Rice, who's a diabetes expert at Vanderbilt. It's an incredibly difficult problem. Everyone thinks they have a way to do it, and everybody so far has failed.
Well, and then the other side of it is, of course, getting the regulatory approval. I had a chance to moderate a panel on this exact topic a few years ago at CES, and you had consumer medical device companies as well as ones in the industry that had to be regulated. And the problem, of course, is the lead time, you know, 2 years. And so can you build something for an Apple Watch that's going to be relevant and have the same size and shape? I mean, you know how Apple likes to change connectors and sizes and cases. And so by the time you get approval, have they wanted to move on from that same technology, that same style, that same shape? I interviewed a company that was doing, with heart rate measuring and be able to do on the back of the iPhone case for an EKG monitor so that it would snap on.
I have
iPhone.
That, the Cardia.
Right. And it took, I think, 2 years for regulatory. But by that time, then the iPhone is a totally different shape.
Right.
And it won't snap on anymore. And
but this thing is cool. And it works with Android as well as iOS. And it's really small. You don't have to snap it on. They now come with a thing you glue
this is different
on.
Yeah.
The Cardia, right. It's Vic Gundotra, the guy who was big at Google, yeah. Google Plus, left to go to a LiveCore, and that's. But they did get FDA approval. It is available. It's $80, and I have to say, if you have AFib, if you have a heart issue, Jeff Jarvis, one of our contributors on This Week in Google, has been hospitalized for AFib several times, and he has this, and he can send an EKG. If he feels weird, he sends an EKG to his doctor. And the doctor can say within minutes, get to the hospital or it's okay.
Right.
That's huge. But I'm wondering, so now we know it's A, very difficult to do the glucose monitoring. B, it's years away no matter what, because they got to get FDA approval. Why does Tim Cook keep bringing this up?
Well, I mean, I think Apple really does care about health. I mean, I think we saw that
cynic. I think it's like all a game.
Think about this. Well, look, think about, marshaling the forces to when you realize that, hey, you know, people, not everyone can stand. Well, let's literally devote an entire team to work with people who are wheelchair bound and who then, you know, and have to, you know, monitor their activity, work with folks who are in wheelchairs and have to really study how they move, what types of exercises, and really drill down on that. Swimming, a whole range of different activities to get people moving and a better life. So I'm not terribly cynical about this. Also, think about, I mean, look,
you wear an Apple Watch, don't you?
I do, and it certainly has made me healthier to hit, you know, certain steps every day and monitoring breathing.
I agree with you.
Chin, yeah. And stuff.
I agree with you.
It's the number one niche, and it's the reason.
You're not wearing one.
Yeah, yeah. It's fine.
Oh, you are wearing one.
Yeah, yeah, and it's fine. But I think trust is at the center of this, and I don't think the market is emerging, but we're not talking about humans now. We're talking about the market that will emerge, and I don't think Apple is. I think they're looking 5 and 10 years down the line, and I think that you really have to bake in. You have to start planting this top of mind awareness with consumers
really
very early.
Now?
I think so.
Really is a change then. You're really, because
I'm cynical, Leah. I'm a journalist and it's my job to disbelieve all the things, especially when Flax emailed me. I disbelieve all the things.
Yeah.
But I think that Apple sees, maybe Tim Cook buys into this, maybe he doesn't, but what I think they see is an emerging market, and they see an emerging market that may take a long time for Apple to earn consumer trust.
So
yeah, and
go ahead.
Go ahead, Tim. Oh, I thought Tim would speak. Sorry.
Whoever wants to talk. You, Clayton, go ahead.
Well, no, I was going to say, I think that there's a lot to unpack with this, because Apple could also, if it's approved in the right ways, could be subsidized by your insurance.
Yeah.
So imagine an industry where these watches are subsidized by insurance. And if the app, drops the price.
Look, Apple is so big that probably they don't consider anything that's not a multi-billion dollar business worth their energy. This is a big business, and if it were any other company, it'd be an Uber-sized company. I mean, this is huge if they can make it. I don't deny that at all. There's a sniff test, that is what I'm saying, where I'm starting to sniff a number of leaks, quotes from Apple that feel to me like they're desperately trying to look like they are relevant and cutting edge, when if you didn't look at any of that but merely looked at the products they're putting out, it would be quite the opposite. I mean, when you say the AirPods are the coolest thing Apple's released in 3 years.
Who said that?
I say it. Right?
That might be the coolest thing.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
Yeah, I know. I'm just saying that. When you say that's the coolest thing, a pair of Bluetooth earbuds, this is a company that isn't cutting edge. And I think that they're really... Look at this. Another leak to Mark Gurman at Bloomberg a couple of days ago. Apple is working on a dedicated chip to power AI on devices. That's clearly an Apple house leak to say, no, because Google said the same thing at Google I.O. Yeah. And we're doing that too. I mean, I feel like this is Apple almost desperate.
But do we have expectations that these, I mean, this is the way the industry works and the way it's worked for a long time. And it's particularly the way Apple has worked for a long time. I think that these leaks are... You say relevant, I say top of mind awareness, but I don't know that cutting edge really is in the cards for consumers anymore.
It reminds me when Microsoft, when Apple announced the iPad, said, oh, we got a big ass table.
Yeah.
We've been doing that for a long time. The Surface. It's somebody in the chat room said, and I think I couldn't agree with them more, Apple's sliding into Ballmer land. The difference between... This is RF 2020. The difference between public relations, propaganda, vaporware, and authentic marketing is the difference between Steve Ballmer and Elon Musk. Apple is moving into Ballmer land.
You know, I think we're going to see a lot of WWDC. I'm fascinated to see what they do.
This is why I bring this up. What happens Monday?
Well, I mean, that's the curious thing. I mean, I'm most interested. I run my entire company off of an iPad Pro, right? There's huge areas that they can improve.
Wait a minute.
iOS.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I use my Mac, obviously.
What are you, a masochist?
I love it. I love the elegance of it. I love
you
the...
It's elegant, I grant you. Huh. But don't you wish you had a keyboard and like
yeah.
Windows?
I do.
And...
I use the software keyboard. Okay. I love it. I like the simplicity of it. I really appreciate just having, you know, split view. I like being able to sit and just focus on what I'm, you know, one task at a time, have split view open.
So you don't feel like it's a compromise for you?
No, I really enjoy, and I like being able to snap it off and just hold it in my hand. And the True Tone display is gorgeous. I mean, I wish all Apple products had True Tone display on it. And once you see it, like Phil Schiller said last year, you're going to wish – you're never going to go back, by the way, and you're going to wish every device had that, which is odd that the iPhone still doesn't have it. So I think with, you know, new iPad hardware, we'll probably see True Tone display on everything. But I think there's huge strides they can make with iOS for the iPad, and I would love to see some really step-up moves on the Pro side on the iPad.
Well, but that's an interesting question right there. What's happening with the iPad? They haven't really – the only iPad announcement they made was a cheap one. They haven't announced anything new in the iPad in a while.
Right, that iPad was really a step back, if anything. Right. And there has been expectations of a new iPad Pro and a new form factor, but ultimately that was pushed back, presumably due to some sort of internal production or design issue.
It was a bogus rumor.
Much like the last MacBooks were delayed effectively because of some issues internally as well, and that's why we wound up with new MacBooks with touch bars, because ultimately they didn't know what else to give us, more or less. So there are definitely internal issues with Apple as well, not only in terms of being creative and coming up with mind-blowing products, but actually getting these regular updates to market even. And so, you know, I think I have a doubt even whether they can maintain a regular cadence of these new products, even if they are pretty predictable updates.
Do you think that Apple will announce new iPads on Monday? I mean, a week from Monday, June 5th?
I wouldn't doubt it either. Yeah. I mean,
really?
I think they need to. I think they're way overdue at this point. And, but the only, you know, there's been suggestions that maybe there's a new form factor that's going to be shared between iPad and iPhone. And so for that reason, we may not see the new iPad until the end of the year. But, you know, I think it's time, even if it is just a predictable spec update for the iPad Pro and for the other iPads, I think, you know, we're overdue for that kind of thing. And so unless they want to try to do everything in September, it would make sense for them to try to do that now, especially if we're talking about more productivity-focused updates for the iPad Pro. And by the way, I actually use my iPad a lot for productivity now, too. Just like Clayton, I've come to appreciate the fact that I can focus on a given document and write something without having notifications pop up all the time. But I tried to do photo editing on my iPad at an event a couple months back and absolutely just wanted to throw the damn thing out the window. So there are certainly times when I
think Lightroom on the iPad. Actually, Lightroom's a very interesting product for the iPad because it ties to your desktop. But you can do some simple editing on the iPad, or at least triage.
And right, then, but the act of importing, editing, and exporting and uploading it took me hours and hours, which would have taken me 20 minutes on my MacBooks. There are definitely situations where the iPad isn't there yet.
Tim and Clayton, I'd actually be very curious about your process. I have to produce copy, but also video content. And as a productivity device, that opportunity cost of time is, it feels insulting when I go, damn it, all I got to do is move this graph from here to here, and this took 7 minutes?
Yeah. That's what I mean when I said a masochist. Yeah. Yeah, I feel
right. I mean, my biggest – there are some areas where I do a lot in Dropbox on my iPad. So if I'm sending something to a client and I want to have, you know, multiples of something that I need to send them, okay, three PDFs, not just one that's stored in Dropbox. Right. Now I have to go back and open, you know, Dropbox again, go through that subfolder, go all the way down. You know, why can't I select three when I'm in there? Nope, I can only grab one. I mean, those are severe areas of restriction. And I think hardware is clear. I mean, we haven't seen an update to the larger iPad Pro, the 12-inch one, since 2015. I mean, that was the first one, so it's been a year and a half. That's definitely long in the tooth. But I want to see what they really do on iOS, because, I mean, the hardware is fantastic. I mean, the iPad Pro is pretty darn good. The camera's pretty darn good. It's pretty darn fast. Obviously,
Clayton, you're not taking pictures with your iPad, are you?
I have. If it's near me, I'll grab it. And we've got an 8-month-old, and in fact, no joke, I didn't have my iPhone with me because it was in the house, and the baby started crawling for the first time, and iPad was there, and I grabbed it and grabbed and shot video of her crawling for the first time on the iPad Pro. So
she's like, Daddy, pick up your phone and put down a tablet.
She's like, Daddy, where'd your face go? Now. There's a giant tray.
You're carrying. So I have to say, I have become apostate. I am going rogue. I'm sitting in front of a giant Windows machine, the Surface Studio, which I happen to really like. I really wanted to like the new MacBooks. I bought the new MacBook Pro. The touch bar is so problematic for me.
Aggravating.
Mm-hmm. I traded down to the touch barless version. And then I said, but now I only have two Type-C ports. So I ended up getting a Windows laptop with USB and HDMI and Ethernet and Type-C and two Type-Cs. I feel like and this is what I'm going to be doing my Lightroom on.
Yeah.
A ThinkPad, not a Mac. And believe me, I was an avid Mac guy for a long, long time. I just feel like Apple's maybe lost its way a little bit. Here's the leak. 9to5 Mac apparently got a hold of some cases. This is sometimes an indicator of what a new device will look like, the case manufacturers. Although it's my understanding, I talked to Griffith some years ago, Apple never gives samples of anything to anybody ahead of time. They just say, wait until it comes out, then you can design your case. But Pelican, which makes a rugged case, and somehow this leaked out, and it is a different dimension. It is apparently for a 10.5-inch iPad Pro. If that's the case, if maybe they had some insight from Apple, maybe this will be announced on June 5th. Maybe that's the... I would love to see it.
It's not. I don't know how difficult it is for them to quickly change a camera hole on one of these things.
This could just be a prototype, you think?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, Tim and Dan, you know this. You'll get those. You'll get press releases immediately after Apple announces these things, right. And they'll have all sorts of colorful pictures from Griffin, from Belkin, and all these cases will hit your inbox, right? Like, that's amazing.
How did they know?
You know,
yeah,
they're all just they're all just renderings. I mean, I don't think anything actually really exists. Maybe they do. They've got prototypes. They have some idea maybe where this camera hole will go. I don't know. And then they get them cranked out pretty darn fast.
And, As much as that's funny, Clayton, you are absolutely right. And let's not forget the lessons of this previous election cycle, the value of earned media, right? So a leak that shows up, that it could be totally ginned up, but it shows up in your inbox or Tim's inbox or my inbox, and then one or two or five or 50 of us all do a story, that branding alone is worth considerable money to the company that's pitching you. They could be a peripheral company, whatever. Like, that company gets a lot of value even if the story isn't true.
Yeah, it's true.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So if you're like iBob's Cases, right? Nobody's ever heard of you.
Yeah, Pelican's gotten a lot of... Yeah, look at all this advertising,
right.
Pelican.
Right, this is... Right, exactly.
And all you really had to do is render something and put it in a silicon mold. And,
yeah, yeah, right. This is earned media for companies. And they pitch journalists in technology because they know a lot of us need to, like...
We're desperate.
Step out the door. I mean... Fortunately,
especially if you're covering Apple, man, you're just desperate at this point.
It's Jason like, sees that and he goes, "Oh, brother."
Yeah.
So
Jason Snell.
So Leo, I'm so curious, this move to Windows, what would it take for you? Because I feel the same way about the MacBook Pro. I mean, I the touch bar, the only reason I use it is for Touch ID. I don't ever use, I'm in Calendar and I don't even know what's popping up.
Yeah.
I'm in Fantastical.
Siri keeps jumping
AirMail.
Out.
It's like a stopgap measure to something.
Did Unix go Ubuntu?
What would it take for you to go back to a MacBook Pro? What would you need for it to be killer?
Well, one of the things that's changed, and one of the reasons I can actually even contemplate using Windows, is that nowadays, and I think you're all probably in this boat too, a lot of our computing is kind of operating system independent. I mean, I live in Chrome.
Right, it's in the cloud.
Chrome looks the same everywhere.
Right.
I'm using Adobe's products, Lightroom and Photoshop. That looks the same on both platforms. A lot of what I do is cloud-based, so it doesn't really matter what hardware I use. So really, I'm choosing now, at this point, I'm choosing machines. The thing about the Windows ecosystem is there's hundreds of manufacturers, and they're all struggling to do something innovative. So if with Apple, you don't like the touch bar, you're kind of screwed. There's only one person making it. With Windows... You don't like that? Get this. If you don't like this, get the other thing.
My workday, my productivity day starts in macOS. I then toggle over to Windows 10, and then
that's
I go to Ubuntu.
Why do you use?
And here's why. So because I can get stuff done in Windows 10. So I tip the best, the best Windows hardware is Mac hardware, right? So just
that's
just,
what Walt Mossberg always said. Yeah.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah,
it is. I'm not kidding you. Windows
okay,
runs
I
like
would
a
disagree
dream.
With you. This Lenovo,
all right.
It's an OLED screen, 10-point touch. It comes with a stylus. It's got normally the trackpad on Apple's are light years ahead of anything that you can get on Windows. This one is, I would say, as good as the glass trackpad.
And as a ThinkPad, does it have the little red nipple?
It has a little red nipple, which you can disable, and I did immediately because I never understood the value of that, but some people love it. It has ports. It has three USB 3 ports. It has two Type-C Thunderbolt 3 ports. It has a full-size HDMI port. It has a micro SD reader. I don't know why. I don't know. I would like a regular SD card reader, but that, I mean, and this is the same price as a comparable MacBook.
And look at that, the Samsung Pro, Chromebook Pro.
That's an amazing Chromebook.
Is that Intel M processor?
Yeah.
Why do I need a MacBook when I can blaze on that thing?
Well, that's kind of my point.
And put Linux on it.
And I think Apple is suffering at a very bad time from a lack of imagination because there is competition. And, you know, for a long time, I felt very comfortable saying Mac OS is superior to anything else out there, even Linux.
Sure.
Because it had a BSD kernel, because you could use a real terminal. And I'm sorry, that's the biggest thing I miss on Windows. Yeah, you got Linux
for
Windows.
Yeah, the terminal is.
I miss the terminal. That's really a nice power tool. But
iTunes?
You miss iTunes? Who would miss iTunes?
No.
Who? Who misses iTunes?
Exactly. What a biffed opportunity that was. And another broken Apple product.
Yeah. Yeah, there are little things that Apple does that you really wonder, like, what isn't there anybody in charge of this? Search on the Apple Store
dismal.
Is just broken.
And there are so many companies that game the SEO in iTunes or in the App Store. That is big
Apple
business.
Apple knows that's a problem,
yeah,
and they're working,
yeah.
I think, to get rid of that, but it's not been fixed yet. I don't know. I mean, I don't mean to bash Apple. I think a lot of people think I'm now an Apple basher. I don't mean to. I want Apple to succeed. In fact, I'm rooting for them. I want them to be the Apple of old, but I feel like, and there is that, we started with the Apple campus, there is that old story. It's like being on the cover of Sports Illustrated. It's a jinx. When a company builds a giant corporate headquarters, that usually means it's the beginning of the end. They're at the apex.
I will tell you, Apple treats me with respect. There are problems with their product. Well, look,
As a consumer or as a journalist?
Actually, as a consumer.
Okay.
Well, let me give you a great example. The iPhone 7, these are unlocked phones, and there is the Apple upgrade program. There is one model of that is hardware locked to AT&T. Apple knows about this, and they communicate with their customers about this, right? So if you want to go to Verizon or T-Mobile and you want to leave, even though you have an unlocked phone, it is one model that's locked to AT&T. AT&T, of course, is AT&T, and they're a pain in the neck to work with. Apple will, for months, walk you through. They
what?
Will take care of you. This morning,
they'll help you unlock it?
Oh, my goodness. I had the best experience with Apple.
Well, I wonder
they said,
how AT&T
not
feels
only that, they
that.
Refunded me the price of that phone. They said, this is our mistake. It
wow.
is our manufacturer. We've had a tremendous, and this is off record. I won't tell you the store, but they said, we have had a tremendous problem working with AT&T. This
wow.
was the iPhone 7, and we just had a manufacturing batch that was tied to AT&T. We are going to refund you.
Wow.
This, and they, I'm not kidding. This was, I agree with you
100%.
I feel respected by
them. I agree with you 100%. There's no better support anywhere. You can go into a store. They are really good. They do say sometimes dumb things, but they're generally very good. And at least when it comes to their profit center, the iPhone, they do better than anybody, at all. And I'll go ahead and try to get some support from Samsung.
Right.
And who are you going to get? Yeah. Who are you going to call? With your right. Dell, or who are you going to call with your Lenovo?
One of the reasons I bought the Lenovo is they still do good support. And I spent $300 on next business day on-site replacement, and including accidental. And it wasn't very expensive. And they will come to me. They're in 160 countries and replace it. And it was Cory Doctorow told me about that. Huh. Cory only buys Lenovos. Of course, he immediately puts Linux on it.
Yeah.
That's, by the way, the other reason I bought it. Is there's a fallback. I can always put Linux on it. But he said, no, because I'm a writer. I can't be out of pocket for a day. So I buy Lenovos. And he says, the one thing I treat myself to once a year, I buy a new Lenovo ThinkPad because I can get next business day on-site replacement. and I will be able to continue to write. By the way, that's the other thing. This actually has a nice keyboard. You can't tell me any current Apple MacBook has a decent keyboard. Oh, they're horrible.
No.
That's why you guys don't mind typing on glass or a little flimsy fabric thing.
I will not type on glass. I actually had the Microsoft iPad keyboard, which is actually not a bad typing experience. That's right. But yeah, I don't like the new Mac keyboards either, and certainly I could not type on glass. No way.
Go ahead. Just play with that keyboard there while we take a break. It's so nice. Lenovo still makes great keyboards, I have to say.
They do. Now,
I put Lenovo in the doghouse after the Superfit. Oh, let me unlock it for you. I'll use my
keyboard. No. I just want the stroke. It feels like a mechanical keyboard.
It feels like a nice – it's not as good as like maybe 5-10 years ago ThinkPads, but it's still – it's
superior to
most companies now are just really putting crap keyboards because they want everything to be thin. No travel.
You get a solid hour and a half battery life out of that, right?
Yeah, that's a sad thing. They claim, can you believe this? They claim 15 hours battery life. I don't know what they're doing. I get 3 to 4, which is okay. I'm not going to complain. But you're right. It's nothing like your 10-hour iPad. I agree with you on that. Yeah, that's kind of pathetic, isn't it? Our show today brought to you by ZipRecruiter. If you are in the powerful but maybe not enviable position of doing the hiring at your company, you know that everything's resting on your shoulders. The person you hire can make the company. A company is just a bunch of people, right? So great employees are transformative. And a bad employee, you're going to be suffering. You're going to pain. It's going to be painful. So it's a big deal being in charge of hiring. And of course, it always happens at the worst possible time. You know, it's you're at the end of a quarter or you're down a person. If you're a small company, even that could be, you know, you're like in the penalty box. ZipRecruiter is going to transform your life. It makes hiring the right person easy as can be. First of all, let's presume the right person's out there. The question is, how do you find that person? How do you get to them? There's more than 100 job sites in the world. How do you get on the one that person's looking at? You go to ZipRecruiter. One click of the mouse, one posting on ZipRecruiter goes to 100-plus job sites, plus Twitter, plus Facebook. So it gets out there. It gets to the most people possible. And then I know immediately people say, well, that's terrible. I'm going to get all those calls, all those emails. No. This is the beauty part. It all flows into the ZipRecruiter interface. They reformat all the resumes so they're uniform, so you can scan them quickly. You can even put questionnaires on the posting. Yes, no questions, true, false, multiple choice, essay questions. So you can have a kind of a screening process built right in, which means you can eliminate the wrong person fast, rank the rest of them, and hire the right person. In fact, over 80% of the jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in less than 24 hours. That's how fast it happens. And no juggling emails, no calls to your office. Look at the million-plus companies and some of the biggest companies in the world that use ZipRecruiter. We use ZipRecruiter. We love it. Screen, rate, and hire the right person fast. Find out right now why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the exact person you need by trying it free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/twit. ZipRecruiter.com/twit. We thank them for making a fabulous, fabulous product. I think we can stop talking about Apple. It's hard. You know, it's funny. Somebody in the chat room said, and this is so true, Apple gets such unearned press constantly, right? We love talking about it. I don't know. I guess it goes back.
It's intriguing.
It goes back to the Steve Jobs days, right?
And there's a ton of products that are about to be announced or not, or software. And there's and think about how many millions of people use their products. It's worth.
That's a good point. I mean, they are the most valuable company in the world. I mean, it's not like Apple's suffering and failing. They're doing okay. There is one more little Apple tidbit before we move on. One way we kind of know when new products are coming out is that the Apple Store gets warned. The employees get warned, you can't take a vacation. And the blackout dates for the Apple Store staff imply, this is a memo sent to Apple Care workers, actually, that it will be September 17th that we will hear, or maybe even be able to buy new iPhones. Now, that's a Sunday, but typically they do hold those iPhone events in September. This has got to be the first one in the new campus, right?
Yeah, I would think so.
You'll come out for that, won't you, Clayton? You'll come out
for that. I will, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
That would be something to see. I just want to see the new campus. It's a challenge. Apple, like everybody else, like Samsung, has got to figure out something to make people come back to the store more than once every few years. Not easy to do. Let's talk about Google. Big victory yesterday for AlphaGo. Three in a row against the world's best Go player, Kujie. This happened in China. I was told, I have not been able to independently verify this, that the YouTube stream of the games have been blocked in China. That they don't, the government doesn't want people to see a machine build
beat a Go champion.
Beat
an American machine.
That's right.
An American machine. AlphaGo, and this is it's retired now. It beat him decisively. Three games in a row, and it's retiring.
Just like Nico Hamilton in F1, you win the world championship, you step away, and you know what else are you going to do?
Go out on a high note. I wish a few football players would learn this. The research team, this is a press release from Google, behind AlphaGo will now throw their considerable energy into the next set of grand challenges. Developing advanced general algorithms that one day could help scientists as they tackle our most complex problems. Sounds like it's following in Watson's footsteps. Watson was based on Deep Blue, right? The chess-playing robot.
Yep.
Such as finding new cures for diseases, dramatically reducing energy consumption, or inventing revolutionary new materials.
There are some people who, within the machine learning community, I mean, some are like Ben Goertzel and they're a little aspirational, but some people really believe that Google is inches away from AGI.
Skynet?
right. No, that's in the past.
We've already been there. We already did that. What is AGI?
Artificial General Intelligence. So artificial intelligence is a frequently misapplied term that can be broadly applied to many different topics. You get a little more specific when you talk about machine learning or you talk about algorithms. But these things, we are already living in an age that is defined by machine learning and will be continued to be defined by machine learning. But often this is what's called narrow artificial intelligence. This could be like anything from a
Winning a chess is easy.
Right. But artificial general intelligence and what AlphaGo has done with Go. And by the way, this Go, my very first, I've been playing Go for 15 years.
Oh, you're a Go player.
Oh yeah. I've been playing. Go is a peaceful game. If you want to both challenge your mind and kind of have a peaceful, relaxing experience with someone, I really encourage you to play Go. If you're on iOS, there's a great app called Smart Go Khifu.
I have to try this. I played Go when I was a kid. I played chess much more seriously. I remember when the chess community, when Kasparov was beaten by Deep Blue.
It was a big deal.
It was not only a big deal, it was kind of depressing. It was like, oh, our game is solvable. A computer can best a human, and the chess community's kind of come around. They now train with.
But this is the real interesting nuance of both Go and artificial general intelligence. So what artificial general intelligence is are algorithms that first they teach themselves what Go is.
Oh dear!
They teach themselves that
can't possibly
Go is
be good.
First, I have to know what a pixel is. Then I have to know what a computer is. Then I have to know that Go is a game. Go is a game humans play. Go is a game that I need to first figure out the rules. Okay, I figured out these rules. Now let me apply those things. Do you see it's layers and layers and layers?
Yeah.
The artificial general intelligence, and if it can learn what Go is, it can learn what I am, and it can learn, this is called recursive artificial intelligence. Intelligence that looks at itself and its own failures and improves on that. The challenge with Go, of course, is that there are a few rules that define Go. Very few rules. It's a 19 by 19
grid.
As
simple as it can be.
You play black and white stone.
There's only two, one kind of piece.
Right. Yeah. Go is Wei Qi. It means to surround, right? Very simple. But the nuance of Go is that, I mean, the legend is that it was developed by a Chinese emperor to teach his son how to wisely rule his kingdom when he was gone. So Go is full of proverbs. The first proverb of Go is a one-stone jump is never bad, meaning no matter what, do not overextend yourself, but do not underextend yourself. Push past your limitations as far as you are able, right? And so when you take proverbs, right, there's another proverb, hane, at the end of two stones, which means if you see two white stones together and you're playing black, Hane, play at the end of those two stones because it will increase your likelihood of victory. So these proverbs, you extrapolate those to government, to politics, to interpersonal relationships. Go is a game that is designed to teach you how to rule, how to run, and how to be a better person.
So in other words, a computer learning how to play this is significant.
You're exactly right, Leo.
It's light years beyond learning chess. Chess is calculable.
Right.
Chess, you can teach a computer to look 40 moves ahead, which is plenty to win any game. Go, you can't do that.
Right. There are nuances to your humanity, and there are nuances to Go. So when we have artificial general intelligence, it is beyond just machine learning or natural language processing, which are narrow AI. When you get to when this happens, I start to go, I'm going to West County. I'm going to be a
AGI.
Hippie. Yeah, yeah.
This is a picture of the end of the match, a video of the end of the match. A couple of things to note. First of all, Kujia, as the player on the left, is the world champion. He's got 30. They started with 3 hours each. He's got 32 minutes left. AlphaGo has nearly 2 hours left because, frankly, AlphaGo's got plenty of time.
Yeah.
It actually moved every minute just because.
Which is also a
didn't want to embarrass
key
the human
component of AGI that it is speed as well as just ability.
The other thing I found interesting is AlphaGo doesn't try to. Humans try to win decisively, like crush you. I don't know how it is in Go, but in chess. Bobby Fischer always said, I'm here to crush my opponent, physically, mentally, emotionally, crush him. Hmm. And that's how he was such a good player. I'm sure Go, you said,
in
it's peaceful.
In Go, you're supposed to learn from your defeat. and if I beat you, I'm supposed to help you learn how I defeated you.
Well, we do that in chess. At the end of the game, both players will analyze the game, say, what if you had done this and that kind of thing. So there is that collegial feeling. But I have to say that what's interesting about AlphaGo is it's designed merely to win. In fact, it won the first game by the slimmest possible margin, half a point.
Yeah.
Because that's as good as winning by 1,000 points. It doesn't matter. Yeah. Here is
I digressed.
No, this is great. Kujia, look at all the food he's got. On the right, the guy who's just making the moves, the computer's got nothing. He doesn't need food. The computer's doing all the work.
He does. I wonder the processing power that's required for AGI. I mean, this is and for AlphaGo.
Massive.
And how many human batteries do you need to power that?
And watch this, though. Watch this, because this is the end of the match. Kujia is making his final moves. And what you really also see is a picture of exhaustion and, frankly, dejection. You could feel the human player. They're actually, I think, analyzing now.
You know, another nuance of Go is that the game isn't over until it is not like chess where there is checkmate done.
Right.
Right. In Go, the game isn't over until both players concede. So you could be on the losing end.
You kind of have to agree that you've lost.
Yeah, it's called pass. So if I don't pass, I don't end the game, which also means that the human player has to accept defeat internally and say, I have won.
Right.
Or I have lost.
Right.
You see that other Google story this week, the Washington Post one about I'm just curious. I mean, it's fascinating, but talking about that machine learning and what Google knows about us, what Google's trying to understand about the world. And when we buy stuff at a brick and mortar store, that Google is able to now understand that it started with one of their ads.
That's fascinating, too. Yeah. This is called Google attribution, and it's something that we can't do here, you guys can't do on Fox and Friends, which is tell an advertiser, you know, Coca-Cola buys an ad on Fox and Friends. You can't really connect that to sales directly. Google, because they have all the data, can say, yeah, you know that credit card purchase? That's because of that ad on that banner ad on that website. We can connect the two because it's the same person. They say they can anonymize it. I hope they can.
Right. Is there really anything as anonymized data at all?
Well, we've seen in the past that's kind of a myth that people anonymize data all the time, and we've always been able to figure out, you know, given enough data, if you give me 10 searches, I can probably narrow it down to somebody.
Yeah, there are companies Tinium.
If it's not tied to your name, if they know your address, your age, your date of birth, your you know, where you were for dinner last night, you know, even if they don't know who you are exactly, that's enough identifying information, I think, for most people.
The other thing Google's doing, which I think is interesting, is these tensor processing units. One of the things Google did is they gave away TensorFlow, which is their AI engine, so anybody can use it on the Google Compute Cloud. And now they have hardware. This is remarkable hardware Each of these TPU units is a quad core that can do 180 teraflops, and they put them together in big racks that can do 11 petaflops. That's 11. What is a peta? I don't even know. 11 billion floating point operations per second. Somebody pointed out that one of the problems with this is you can use it cheaply and you can use their software for free, but it's proprietary in the sense that anything you do, all the data that you generate with these TPU clusters, it's in Google's cloud. You can't then use Amazon's AI or Apple's AI.
It's kind of the worry with AI that it will be
one company siloed. Alone it.
Yeah.
Siloed. That's a good way to describe it. So what do you guys think? Is it over? Has Google won?
Not yet.
I don't think we know what the battle is exactly. Right.
Okay, that's a good question. What would the
Is it between Facebook and Google for user data and advertising?
I'd say Google has twice the information Facebook does, though, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. Do they? I mean, remember when Facebook wouldn't allow itself to show up in Google search? That great battle, that great Wired magazine article, what was it, like 8 years ago, and that incredible battle where Facebook was keeping all of that data because that was the holy grail. For Google, the more personalized data, the moods, the vacations, the information that you can't get from a simple Google search.
I think Google can get that data.
I think Google gets it peripherally.
Yeah.
They tried with Google Plus.
I think that's why they stopped caring about Google Plus. They're like, the value proposition here isn't as strong as we thought it was. I could be wrong, but
they wanted to get Facebook stuff. But I think that's in effect what happened was they said, we don't need that.
Yeah,
we get it anyway.
Right.
Just because if you just use all Google for all your searches and you use Google devices, and even if you're using an iPhone, you may be using Google Assistant. You may be using you're probably using Google Search.
They're getting email.
Email. You're getting so many signals. Yeah. And really, I don't think it's a question of how much data you have at this point. It's how much intelligence you can apply to the data you have to make the connections. And I feel like Facebook is certainly, data rich, but I feel like computer scientists at Google maybe are a little bit, I don't know. That's a really interesting question. Did you see this? Facebook, according to an Australian news website, which has seen internal research, saw that Facebook was classifying the emotions of teenagers, stressed, anxious, nervous, or otherwise, and then offering it to advertisers who could use it to hone in on teenagers when they're most vulnerable.
Ugh.
According to USA Today, this information was shared with an advertiser. Facebook says, no, we have a process in place to review the type of research we perform. And in this case, maybe we did it. We didn't follow the process. That's right.
We have a process.
We didn't follow it, but we have a process.
I mean, how would that work? I mean, it seems odd to me. I mean, I guess unless it's a high-level advertiser that's spending tens of millions of dollars on, in their ads manager, because there is a process in place. There are only certain campaigns that you can run. There's only access to certain data.
Do you believe the Cambridge Analytical story or not? Because that's
I got sources there like crazy.
So here's the deal, and then you can tell us what's true. This comes to the Trump campaign. Jared Kushner was charged. He started a unit in San Antonio to use data from a company in Britain called Cambridge Analytica, which, among other things, it was alleged that they did Facebook quizzes to gather information about Facebook users, and that the Trump campaign then bought very targeted ads based not merely on whether somebody was likely or unlikely to vote for Trump. That was useful because you could discourage a likely voter for Hillary Clinton not to vote, and you could encourage a likely voter for Trump to vote, but also even using sentiment analysis, do things like, well, we know that, there's a group X, there's a large set of group people who will vote for support of the Second Amendment, who will vote for gun rights. But more than that, we can then subdivide that group by emotion analysis as to why they care about gun rights. Some are hunters. Some are worried about safety and security. Some are libertarians who believe no government interference. And then target an ad specifically, and these are dark ads because no one sees it except that person, target an ad towards those interests. So that was the what was alleged.
So, I buy that.
Well, I'm sorry for jumping. I don't mean to cut you guys off.
Is it true?
So, well,
because we've seen reports now go back and forth.
Yes, the way you characterized it, yes, this is the definition of data analysis on this previous campaign used many of those tactics. But you have to separate Cambridge Analytica from this.
They claim, some say, claimed more than they really were capable of.
So we have all this reporting in Tech Republic. I know the CEO of Cambridge very well. They got into hot water because, yes, they do quizzes. Cambridge made up a lot of their data. This micro-targeting, they use quizzes. This micro-targeting is precisely the real company that – there are a number of real companies that do this. One is L2 Political. If you buy data from L2 Political, you can log in. We could log in right now, and I could show you all of those things about every single – I can find you and see your Social Security number, how much money you make, where you live. I can – you're all of these things that you say. So everything you just said, Leo, is absolutely correct. Whether Cambridge did it or not – follow Garrett Lansing on Twitter. I'll leave that right there. But during the campaign, this was precisely what we covered at Tech Republic, was the data and the data analytics. We didn't cover the horse race because the politics are less interesting.
Well, and as it turned out, you covered the right thing because this, in my opinion, this was the most significant development.
We were finding bots. You can find this on Tech Republic. Find stories from January 2016. We were finding bots buried in the Twitter. You can look at the spikes in Trump and Clinton's Twitter followers and correlate them. Yes, these things happen. And the micro-targeting, every single political campaign, every smart political campaign is buying and using data.
From now on, if you're not, you're going to lose.
Right.
But right?
And being able to go into these towns, I mean, the real story was, the targeting of the ads was huge, but also then being able to use that data for speeches. So they knew down to a granularity that it was almost like the speeches themselves were crowdsourced.
Ted Cruz.
So you could go into
Trump
Phoenix.
Was very good. I mean, this was obvious if you watched him at reading the crowd and feeding them stuff that made them more excited. I mean, there was a direct feed. He didn't have to use any analytics. There was a direct feedback loop.
There is, and in fact, that was the lesson of the campaign. Also, follow Chris Wilson on Twitter. Chris was Ted Cruz's data analytics guy. Ted Cruz really pioneered this, and it was one reason he rose so high. Clayton, what you said is precisely accurate. It is less about the GOTV, the get out the vote, and it's more about targeting the right language that we know will elicit a response. And Garrett's an interesting
guy. Is this Garrett Lansing?
Yeah, that's Garrett. He was the White House. He was in charge of tech at the White House for about 3 weeks.
Under Obama or under Trump?
Under Trump.
Okay.
Garrett's a real good guy. And I'm not saying all I know from Garrett is that he did analytics. So Garrett is not my source. And I won't get him into trouble. I won't reveal who my sources were. But Garrett is somebody who you could turn to for accurate information about data analytics in the current age.
He understands what's
going on. So is Chris Wilson. Okay. And there's no FUD with those guys. Again, I really like the humans at Cambridge Analytica, and I don't. They're going to hate me. They're going to send some emails after the show. But what they did is not what they claimed to have done. They sent emails the day after the campaign. I was at Hillary Clinton's HQ through the campaign. As soon as the tide started to turn, Cambridge took credit for Trump's win.
Okay.
That night.
So okay. But irrespective of that, there are companies doing this kind of thing.
Yes, precisely.
It may not be CA.
Right.
But there are companies doing this kind of thing.
The way you framed that is precisely right,
and,
Leo.
And more to the point, Facebook will sell ads.
Oh, yeah.
Based on that data.
Oh, yeah. Or data scraped from Facebook.
How do you buy an ad like that? You don't say to Facebook, I want to press teenagers, though. You'll know who it is, right?
That's my question because I do a lot of Facebook stuff and for my company, and it's important that I do it. And without it, you know, I'd be.
I don't know why anybody buys ads, and I shouldn't say this out loud, anywhere but Facebook.
Right.
Right. I mean, you can really. that's talk about efficient ad spend, right?
Yep. Right. I mean, yeah, like I said before, I mean, think about it. If you're a pet shop owner in a small town in Massachusetts, or just take that as an example, right? You could, why would you put up a billboard, or why would you put out, take an ad out in the local
billboard?
Newspaper?
Why would anybody buy a billboard these
days?
You're
right, Clayton.
So why wouldn't you then just target pet owners in the three zip codes that your pet shop would service in the little downtown area and run a little coupon on a Sunday for hey, we're new in town. We just opened our store. Pet owners, come to our store. You're going to get a free doggy toy on this particular day. You're only targeting pet owners through the Facebook ad platform.
And web companies do it all the time.
Yeah.
Right. And between 30 and 50 years old, right? Maybe you're not going to target.
The only thing that saves us, by the way, is that at least people, when they buy ads on Twit, they know you're getting geeks. I mean, you're getting a tech enthusiast. So just by virtue of the content, we are a somewhat narrow niche. But boy, I would really worry if I were network television, a newspaper, a Clear Channel selling ads on billboards. You can't compete.
And Clayton,
well, I mean, this is why this.
Your sophistication is you are doing and you are advocating the exact right tactic. It is that other industries aren't as sophisticated as geeks.
They're going to have trouble going down the road because Procter & Gamble, which, by the way, is that sophisticated, is going to eat their lunch.
Yeah.
My question is, how are they getting this data? How are they getting the depressed teenager data? I mean, because if you go through the ads manager as a normal company,
Facebook's not telling you, you're saying.
Right. You can't find that data in there. You can find people's credit history and if they own a mortgage and if they have,
Facebook quizzes. Facebook
quizzes.
Or if they
listen to some saddy music or like maybe they're posting feelings and sentiment data.
So if I create quizzes, let's say, what Game of Thrones character are you? And I create a quiz, and those things spread virally on Facebook like wildfire. I get the data from that quiz, right? I mean, Facebook gets it, but I also get it, right? Well, is that one way to do this?
How would you do it? I'm just trying to think through the ads manager platform. I don't know how that would work.
But you don't understand. I'm not saying through the ads manager. I'm saying you create content on Facebook.
The Cure, exactly.
And then you're retargeting. So that's how you're getting it. So then you're able to see if the 100,000 people that answered your quiz on your Facebook page, the Donald Trump Facebook page, answered it that they are sad.
Part of the reason this works is Facebook's very lax privacy policies, which allow you, for instance, if somebody answers a quiz, to get not only information about that person, but about their friends.
Right? Yes. And we as individual buyers, are not an enterprise company or a highly influential
individual. So Clayton's
individual.
Not getting the good stuff.
So there are not. But, Clayton, you and I and everybody in the media, if I want traffic, I can arbitrage it. I can buy it off of Facebook. And I don't necessarily need to get very granular about that until I have my own analytics systems on top of that. So if you think about political campaigns who don't only rely on Facebook, but sometimes rely on Facebook, and you have your own analytics processes and really smart data scientists who all want to be influential inside an administration or go to jobs in the private sector. It's not just Facebook data. Facebook data is part of the bigger picture. Again, check out L2 Political if you want to see how this works.
Are political campaigns the most sophisticated users of this data at this point?
That's why I'm saying geeks are. Because, Clayton, what you're describing is stuff that, a lot of those tactics we kind of know, or if you're a small business or even a larger SMB, an enterprise company, you might know some of these tactics. But a political campaign, look, I know political campaigns, and they're not that sophisticated.
That's reassuring, by the way. I'm very glad to hear that, because whether you buy Tide or not is less important than who gets elected president. Yeah. So it's nice to know that. But I do have to say that there are people who do know this.
Yeah,
they are going to, survival of the fittest. They are going to become more and more successful, more and more powerful. Eventually, this will become the province of election campaigns. How does this change? What we're really seeing is, and we've seen this for years, big data, right? More and more big data, better ways to process big data. And then there are some companies, and maybe Google's the one, but there are some companies who have a head start, such a lead in this, that they will only make them stronger and stronger. Their lead will magnify as a result. Yeah. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. When do they become a monopoly of this data?
They are, though, right? Facebook is, I mean, you can't say
yeah,
Google.
I guess.
The data Google has is unique to Google.
Well, then you have this move by, you know, cable companies and, yeah, but it's, you know.
But Google is everywhere you go on the internet is Google. You know, not Cox, not Comcast. And in fact, what do you think Google's been pushing? HTTPS everywhere, right? This is mm-hmm. Google's pushing this very hard. Your Google searches, for instance, are encrypted. Your ISP does not see those searches. All they know is that you're using Google. And Google wants this for every website. In fact, they've even already said, we will rank you higher if you're a secure website. We made Twit secure, not because there's anything on Twit. We don't know anything about you. There's no account. You don't create an account on Twit. But we made it secure because it helps our ranking in Google.
So you think this is Google playing defense against the ISPs?
You bet.
Yeah.
That way, Google has a monopoly on that information.
That's so
nobody
smart.
Else does.
Yeah.
Well, and they're scared. You know, I spoke to an IT genius the other day and over coffee, and the guy's quite brilliant. He's started a number of companies and sold them, multimillionaire. And he said, you know, the real trouble right now for ISPs is that when you come home, most people aren't switching to Wi-Fi. And
oh, really?
They're using their
carrier.
LTE.
Wow.
Because LTE is, you know, just fast enough. It's fine. And most people kind of forget to jump to Wi-Fi. I know my mom, you know, parents come home. They don't jump over to Wi-Fi because That's they're home. Funny. We do it kind of instinctually. But now there's this real fight. You know, Verizon doesn't want to build any more fiber to the home. And now they're really targeting these new.
That's interesting. That would explain why Google and Verizon have stopped their fiber initiatives.
Right. They're done.
Happier
they're
if
done.
You use the carrier.
The future is the spectrum that's available. And it's going to be wicked fast.
5G, right?
Yeah,
5G. 5G probably not till 2020. 5G.
Just in time for the next election. This is why, by the way, I think you can make a strong case that Mark Zuckerberg will run for president and other technocrats will run for president because they will be. I really feel we are at a paradigm shift. I hate to use that phrase. We're at the bend of the hockey stick.
Yeah.
And and things are going to rapidly change. The next 5 years, 5 years from now will not look anything like this today, I would guess. And AI will be the driving force behind that. Yes? You guys are smart, you'd think. Will The Rock be the next president because he can because he's stronger than the rest? Let's take a break. We've got a great panel. Clayton Morris is here, Fox and Friends. And let's not forget morrisinvest.com, where he teaches you how the miracle of residential real estate, which,
that's right,
by the way, Lisa and I are all in on. We're
I know. We got to talk about it.
Last time
Come
you
on
were
over.
On, I went to Lisa. I said, we got to do this. This is
We've
brilliant.
Had you know, so many Twit listeners have come and
they can retire.
To the podcast.
I'll be working here for 20 more years. They're going to retire.
Most people think it's super difficult to do it. And really, you know, if you think about it, you add up your monthly expenses.
Oh, that should be you. That should be you and Natalie.
On our website?
Yeah, that's clip art. I want you, Natalie. I want Miles.
I didn't want it to be about me. I rebuilt the whole website to be about people, like other people helping them achieve financial
but
freedom.
You did pick a family that looks kind of like your family.
I was like, all right, I see some smiling people that look like they might be real estate investors.
A little bit like you, except you need a baby in the back there.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, the common investor that I work with is like, I'm tired of driving 2 hours to work back and forth.
They
have got two kids at home. I'm tired of being selfish, you know.
Also, we've got the great Dan Patterson. First, I didn't realize that he's been on the show many times. First time in studio.
Wonderful to be here.
I have met you physically, though, haven't I?
But this okay, is good. This is a truly wonderful thing to see.
Thank you for being here.
Thank
and
you.
And it's you know, I think you got some stuff. I want to ask more questions about this.
I'm
work
sorry
you've
for
been
battling,
doing.
Guys.
No. I want to know. You can read Dan at TechRepublic.com. Yeah, yeah. Really interesting stuff.
We talk AI. I get worked up, Leo.
It's exciting. And Tim Stevens, he's always a pleasure to have on from TheRoadShow.com. Up there in Upper New York State, where nothing changes year to year. They still have a milkman up there bringing you the milk, yeah?
As a matter of fact, we do.
I knew it. As long as there's a milkman, I think life can continue.
Do you live up there near there's so many celebrities that live up that way. Mark Ruffalo lives up there, right? The Matthew Reese and what's her name from The Americans?
I couldn't tell you.
Carrie, no idea.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, that's the point. They all are up there, but nobody knows. It's secret.
Right. You come up here, you want your privacy, and I get that.
Plus, Bob there's Dylan. Nothing like the smell of manure in the morning. I love that.
That was in the spring, Leo. We're well past that.
We used to vacation up in Upper New York State at Cooperstown because my dad was a baseball fan in Lake Otsego. And I'd always know we were almost there because I smell the cows. Actually, to me, the smell of sweet grass and cow manure is actually very pleasant.
Like the lagoon.
Yeah, it's good for me. Yeah, I grew up in a farm in Vermont. So,
yeah. I feel excited when I smell it.
You know, we're talking about Kickstarters. There's a new Kickstarter that you can order manure on the internet and deliver right to you.
Is that true?
No, but I'm going to start it.
I like it. We've got the manure. If you've got the raised beds, we've got the manure. Petaluma has a fragrance. A couple of times a year, they fertilize. That's all I'm going to say. I don't want to conjure any particular image in your mind. smells like victory. Our show today brought to you by the nicest sheets I've ever slept on. These sheets are amazing. Bowl and Branch. Now, you may say, why are you talking about sheets, Leo? But I got to tell you, I think we've learned that a healthy sleep, a good night's sleep, is key to your overall well-being, not just your mental state, but your physical state. We know that, cortisol, the stress hormone, can keep you from sleeping. But getting a good sleep habit and a comfortable bed, we've talked about mattresses. Let me talk about the bedding on the mattress. That can make a huge difference. Boll & Branch sheets are made from 100% organic cotton. Now, you can talk about cotton, you can talk about thread count and all that stuff, but I can tell you this. I've made the mistake of buying $1,000 sheets that were not comfortable because they were too crisp. Boll & Branch, it's the softest cotton you've ever, and they get softer as you use them. They're so beautiful. And they don't sell at department stores, so there's not that crazy markup. They only sell online. You're getting about twice the quality for literally half the price. They say this, and I've never questioned it more. Three former U.S. presidents sleep on Boll & Branch. You pick the three. I don't know who it is. Countless celebrities. I sleep on Boll & Branch, and I love it. Feel good about your sheets. Not only knowing that they're organic cotton produced responsibly, but also ethically made sheets, but also the most comfortable sheets you've ever slept on. And of course, you could try them for 30 nights and see for yourself. If you're not impressed, return them. You get every penny back. Forget lugging around a bed and a bag and a busy department store. Go to bowlandbranch.com. It's easy to order. In fact, if you use the promo code TWIT right now, you'll get $50 off your first set of sheets and free shipping. B-O-L-L, like the Cotton Bowl, right? B-O-L-L, and not the Cotton Bowl football game, the Cotton Bowl, the bowl of cotton, the ball of the bowl of the, never mind. B-O-L-L and branch, like the branch of the cotton.com. Use the promo code TWIT for $50 off. Free shipping at Boll & Branch, the softest bedding in the world. So I'm following two new people on Twitter now. I got Chris Wilson. He's Wilson WPA. That was Ted Cruz's data guy, right?
Yeah, Chris is brilliant.
And then I'm also following Garrett Lansing.
Sorry, Garrett.
Why sorry? He's an ancient Greek nerd, he says.
Garrett's wonderful. He's wonderful.
Does he want to be under the radar?
No, I don't want to imply that Garrett's my source. He's not. But
no,
I don't
he's not
want
a source. Nobody ever said that.
Right,
he's just a good guy to follow.
I don't want to get Garrett into any trouble by implying he said things that he didn't say. Garrett is just one of those guys who understands data and politics. So
Another great person to follow on Twitter is at Clayton Morris. You should check that out.
I hear he is not only brilliant, but very handsome.
Right.
Yeah, I like that Morris guy. It's too late. I'm already following him.
How are you guys using Twitter these days? We have this debate all the time. I don't know. Do you use it much anymore?
I mean, where's your feelings about Twitter?
Always.
I pretty much just, stream of consciousness, whatever's going on kind of thing. It's not really a promotional tool. But then for me, it was always just a means of communicating and kind of getting in touch with people. It was never much of a promo tool for me. I share what I'm up to, but I never look at it as a way to generate traffic as such.
I have stopped tweeting kind of the random personal tweet. And I realize that if you follow me on Twitter, you're probably following me for tech information and news, right? So what I've started doing, as I'm sure all of you guys do, I have a beat check every morning, every evening. I go around, I go to Tech Meme, I go to a variety, you know, Hacker News, a variety of sites, and I pick articles that we'll be talking about on the shows. I have always used Pinboard, pinboard.in, which was
so good.
It's when it's Yahoo Mache, bought Delicious, they pretty much killed the API. Joshua, I think, is revitalized, or somebody bought Delicious. But the way I work is I'll use Pinboard. I have a little extension, and so all the articles are ended up on Pinboard. And you could follow me. It's a public feed, pinboard.in/u:LeoLaporte. But I've decided to link it using If This Then That or Zapier, one of those tools, to my Twitter feed. So now if I bookmark a story we're going to cover, I might modify the title for a little commentary, and then it goes on my Twitter feed. And actually, that's, I think, the most useful thing I can do on Twitter, which is post articles that I'm going to talk about that I think are interesting with the slightest bit of commentary. How about you?
Yeah, that's really all I use it for. Yeah. I use Linky in iOS and make a nice little post about something I'm reading. I love my paranormal news, and you know, in addition to real estate.
Are you? That's right. You're a ghost hunter. I forgot about that.
Love it. Yeah, I want disclosure, baby. And I think you're into it too. I'm like,
I listen to the UFO podcast all the time. Absolutely.
Really?
Not necessarily proud to admit, but
really.
Yes.
Really?
I am proud of it. I try to do as much of it as I can on Fox, and because I think, you know, there's so much there. If you guys want to have your minds blown, check out Corey Good. And I would even recommend checking out, if you're sort of Gaia.com, check out Cosmic Disclosure. It's a show on Gaia. And Corey Good, interviewed by David Wilcox, a great writer. And a journalist. He's been at this for many, many years. I mean, spoken to people at the highest levels of military.
Please. He says there's a secret space program.
Oh, absolutely. just dive into some of the Apollo, transmissions when they were seeing they were seeing objects on the moon following them.
Secrets of the Apollo missions.
I'm telling you. See, once you go down here and you go with an open mind.
I have a completely closed mind. I think it's crazy. I think you're nuts.
Here's a challenge for you.
Okay.
I'll throw down a Leo challenge. You have So the next time I'm on Twitter, watch all of Cosmic Disclosure. Watch some of those shows, and we'll see if your mind has changed at all. And see if you start to see. I'm telling you, when you start to go down
totally
travel,
different reasons.
I have talked to
you.
I've
find it humorous.
It's entertainment. Like I'm going to bed. Like
I used to listen to what was that Art Bell show?
Yeah, Art Bell. Right.
Coast to coast.
Coast to coast.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've been on Coast to Coast, and I always felt a little dirty afterwards because I feel like here I am talking about real stuff like technology, and then the guy right after me is going to be talking about secret alien autopsies, and it's like, oh, please.
Well, Coast to Coast was kind of like Penthouse Stories because you could pretty much get on there and say anything you wanted to, and that was, I think, entertaining.
All of this
too,
stuff is like Penthouse Stories. You'll never believe what happened.
That's true.
Same dopamine reaction too, right? Dopamine,
I think it's exactly that. But you're a smart guy, Clayton. I'm not going to diss you at all. I'm going to listen to Cosmic Disclosure, and next time you're on, we can talk about it.
Yeah, we'll have it. Just watch every. There's like a couple seasons. Go through it and listen to it, and I would love to hear your thoughts on it. And the guys reverse engineered some of this stuff.
I'm going to Machu Picchu, the ancient Inca ruins in Peru next week. Is there anything I should do while I'm there? Anything I should dig up, look for, secret signs?
When you're at the top, and you'll know this, I'm sure you've read about this, when you get to the top, you're supposed to strip down and be totally nude.
Totally nude, regardless
of how many people are standing around you.
Okay, deal.
Don't even Google that. Just go and do it.
Next week in tech, Leo Laporte arrested for public indecency.
I'll never forget a few years ago, we went to Egypt and went to Luxor and went into the pyramids and stuff. And then we went into one of the ancient tombs, and there was a whole New Age group there chanting. They were holding on to the altar going, and I thought, oh, wow, we must be at the center of something. I didn't feel any better or different, but I.
But you did buy a bonsai tree after that.
But a floating one of that.
You got me. obviously, I do believe in Kickstarter. Okay, I have a deep-rooted belief that Kickstarter is
right,
real.
Fake make-believe things. That...
Oh Lord! Somebody in the chat room said that this the Google Ad Conference. Everybody paid attention to Google I/O, but the Google Ad Conference was really the event that people should have been paying attention to. They call it their Marketing Next conference, and this is where they announced that tool for measuring brick and mortar sales after an ad campaign. He said in the chat room, he said, you should watch the videos. A lot of these videos have been put out here, and advertisers actually are very excited. Advertisers would love to know more about our behavior and what we do and whether their ads work. That was always the saying. I know that half my ads work. The problem is I don't know which half. You know, half.
If you want to be cynical, you could look at a lot of the stuff that came out of Google I/O that was really exciting. You know, the idea of 3D mapping within a building without having to have location building beacons within the building. Well, now you can find your way to the Captain Crunch. But now, you know, Captain Crunch can know how long you stood there standing in the cereal aisle looking at that stuff, too. So even Google Automotive, for example, you know, there's been a lot of resistance among automotive manufacturers to put Android Auto in the car because Google needs to take some information out of that, effectively to know where you are and where you're going. That too could be looked at as a skeptical, as a, you know, a little bit of a tinfoil hat way of saying, you know, this technology is cool and it does give you benefit, but ultimately it just makes Google better at serving you ads and learning more about you. So you can look at this stuff in a lot of cynical ways, and ultimately I think it does make Google very, very, very powerful.
Yeah, Geico could start sending you ads because it knows that you speed or blow through stop signs.
How is Android Auto different from Google Automotive, Tim? Explain what that Google Automotive is.
So right now, if your car has Android Auto, basically your phone is effectively working as a terminal. It's providing an interface, is effectively doing a video out signal and taking over a part of the dashboard of the car. If you do run Android within the dashboard, as we saw some demonstrations from Volvo and from Audi, that actually is Android running natively in the car. And in that case, if there is a native infotainment system there from, for example, Volvo's Sensus system or the Audi MMI system, that actually be running on top of Android. So it's kind of like turning things upside down. Whereas you now have Android Auto running on top of the infotainment system, you would then have the infotainment system running on top of Android. But the net result is the same basic interface, the same basic apps, but you no longer would have to have your phone connected to the car. You'd have Spotify running right there in your car now, and you'd have your playlist right there. You'd have the active data connection in your car serving up that data.
These are Ron Amadio at Ars Technica was on Twig on Wednesday, and these are the pictures he took at the at the event. So this is to compete with QNX and other car operating systems. Microsoft
right, QNX
Auto
is a big player in basically providing the low-level operating systems that then these infotainment systems like Sync 3 are built on top of. There's Linux in the car as well, which is making a big play to
our
be.
Our Teslas are running on Linux.
Right, yeah. And there's a big push to make that a lot more sophisticated than it has been in the past. But this is a huge moneymaker for QNX right now, and ultimately Android wants to be in there as well to have more power. Down low, basically. So that really would mean the foundation of those operating systems would be Android-based, which is, again, a Linux-based operating system.
But that would give Google more power. It's also data for Google, right?
Absolutely. And they're getting, you know, you got to figure Google's getting a lot of that information anyway if you're taking your phone with you. But ultimately, having that in your car means that they know your destination. In theory, they could know your rate of speed. You know, it remains to be seen exactly what Google would be able to take out of the car. But ultimately, if they're tied within the CAN bus of the car, they could, in theory, get access to anything that they wanted to, even whether your turn signal's on or whether traction control activated, which might, you know, mean that they could use that data to then serve Waze. If you slip on a patch of ice in your car, maybe there's an automatic Waze notification that's posted that would then alert drivers behind you. You know, again, there's a case for positives out of this, but if you are concerned about privacy, there's some negative implications too.
And of course,
sell data to the government, perhaps. And you know, I mean, I'm not trying to be cynical. I'm trying to be positive. They maybe could use that information to improve infrastructure and roads in a way that they couldn't before.
Self-driving vehicles, right? If one of the problems self-driving vehicles face is humans driving other cars in the same environment, that's a mess. But maybe if you're driving a car with Android Auto or Google Automotive underneath, at least it can communicate with the self-driving car and say, look, my human's about to do something really stupid, so you might want to just hold back a little bit, that kind of thing.
Yeah, Dave. I think a lot of this is way down the road. You know, right now, this Google system isn't really powerful enough to power all the systems within the car. But definitely building it inside of the dashboard means that it does have easier access to a lot of that data. And that means that it then, you know, down the road could certainly have a lot more power and a lot more communications. And Google has basically always said, you know, we don't need this standardized vehicle-to-vehicle communication system that the National Highway and Traffic Safety Administration has been pushing for decades now. We don't need any of that stuff. Just give our cars an active data connection, and we'll kind of take care of the rest. And this is another step in that direction.
This is another Ars Technica article from Ron Amadio. The state of the car computer. Forget horsepower. We want megahertz. I don't think he's speaking for the car companies. One of the things he pointed out is that car companies have a 5-year development cycle. So many of the car companies that are running Android are running gingerbread, Kit Kat, really old versions of Android.
Wow.
So that's another that's another problem for Google.
Honda is one of the few manufacturers that has Android in the car right now, and it is quite old. That 5-year life cycle is getting better. Ford, for example, did the Ford GT in under 2 years anyway. So there are signs for improvement. But ultimately, you know, the goal is with a system like Android in the dashboard. At that point, you could basically do over-the-air updates relatively trivially. But of course, that's a whole new thing for automotive manufacturers. You know, they're used to writing software once and shipping it and having it be supported for 10 years as is. So the notion that you would need a software update for security reasons in your car, that's kind of a whole new world for a lot of manufacturers, something they're just kind of still getting their heads around.
Right. My wife has the new Volvo, what is it, the XC something, the SUV.
XC90.
Yeah. And, you know, recently there was some software glitches and they had to, you know, you have to drop it off for a day while they take care of it and update the software. It's decidedly inconvenient. Whereas a Tesla can overnight, you could set your download time, you know, when you want the software update to go. And I want it at 11 o'clock at night and it'll be done by 1 a.m. And then you wake up the next morning and it shows you what was in the update, you know, right on your screen. These are the things we updated. And you know, so you have these manufacturers that need you to drop off your car to do a software update.
I had an Audi for 3 years, never got it updated. The maps just went more and more out of date. But my Tesla, we would get updates like every few months now. It's happens all the time. And by the way, Tesla puts in Easter eggs. They're so funny. The latest one before when you normally tap, if you have autopilot, you tap the stem twice to turn on autopilot. If you tap it 4 times now, it does the Super Mario Rainbow Road. And for a while, it was playing, I think, a song from Mario. But now it plays, I Want More Cowbell from Saturday Night Live. And it's like, I don't even. So you just wonder, what else is in this thing? At Christmas, did you do, on my Model X, the doors open. It played a Mannheim Steamroller Christmas song. And it was flying. Really? It was. And they took it out. I was pissed. I wanted to keep doing it.
I want the Super Mario Brothers stuff. I got to check for that.
Yeah. You have to have autopilot. I don't know I don't know. You know.
Yeah.
There's a whole, you know, you can find it on the web, a whole bunch of, I guess, Tesla Easter eggs. So it's interesting because when, for instance, Microsoft did Microsoft Car, they just wanted another market for Windows. It was a Windows CE. Now you got to feel Google is fighting for more than, in fact, they're probably giving it away like they give away Android because they want the data.
Yeah, they want that time spent in car for you to be. No, really, I really think they want that you to be producing 20 minutes, 30 minutes more data and send.
They want data from you every minute of your life.
Right.
They'll put a sensor in your bed.
Right.
They'll put a camera in your bathroom. Actually, isn't that what Amazon's doing with the Amazon Look and the Amazon Show? Mm-hmm. And by the way, I immediately ordered both because I'm an idiot. There's two ways to go. I mean, I'm starting to regret the way I went. But you can either be paranoid and careful and tape over. And I see lots of people taping over their cameras, forgetting that, of course, you have a camera conveniently in your pocket with a microphone and a GPS that's always connected to the internet. So who cares about your laptop?
Those apps are listening.
I know. They could be. In fact, some of them are.
They are.
They listen to the TV.
Yeah, right. Exactly. They are listening.
So I just gave up. I said, oh, screw it. I'm not going to When I install Windows now, I say, do it all. Turn it all on, Microsoft. I got nothing to hide. I don't cover up my cameras. I buy the, you know, look and the show from Amazon. I feel like I've just given up. And, like, what is the worst that's going to... Seriously, I ask you, gentlemen, smart gentlemen of the jury, what's the worst that's going to happen?
When you just also ordered that Amazon stripper pole and you've got the Amazon look next to it.
Yeah. So what? No one wants to see me naked.
If you're bought in, I mean, I like, you know.
And by the way, I will be naked at Machu Picchu about June 8th. Just reminding you of the exciting moment. Yeah.
Get out your wide angle.
yeah, you're going to need it.
I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm the same way as you, Leo. I could go off in the paranoid space, but then you really have to be all in on that. And you really have to start. I mean, you turn off location tracking on your phone.
I try. Then, you try. Good luck. Good luck. You won't. Basically, you'll be going back to the 19th century.
And then also, don't leave your house because now there are traffic cameras everywhere. You want to go down the streets in Manhattan? Every corner has an NYPD traffic camera on it. Try going to London. The whole city is covered in cameras. I mean, what are you going to do?
Should we fight this? Should we all be petitioning our member of Congress?
What are we fighting, and why?
We want privacy. I want privacy.
No,
so if I want, I don't.
No, we don't.
No, because I like all the modern conveniences.
Yeah, totally.
I want Google to remind me. You better leave for work. Traffic's terrible. I wanted to do that.
There's a couple groups of people who need to care, and that's the politicians. I think Anthony Weiner.
I like that. Right. I think that's great. That's going to weed out the bad apples.
Yeah.
Right.
It will. Right.
Yeah. Did you see so? On Silicon Valley, have you been watching the latest season?
Oh, my God. This is my Schadenfreude. I love the show.
So they develop an app. They call it Seafood. So one of the guys living in the house actually wanted to do 28 octopus recipes, and he called it C-S-E-A food. But then they go to the pitch meeting and very quickly pivoted to S-E-E. You see food and can identify it. But he was lazy, so all he could do is identify hot dogs. So it identifies hot dogs or not hot dogs. You take a picture of something. So HBO, in all their brilliance, has developed a hot dog app that does exactly that. You can download, and I encourage you all to do so, the brand new HBO hot dog, not hot dog app. I don't want to mention what it ended up being used for, but let's put it this way. Periscope bought the company because it could be useful at identifying things that are hot dog-like, but not hot dogs. Can you believe that? There's Jin Yang, the founder of the hot or not dog app. Not hot dog app. It's called not hot dog. All right, let's TV. See, this is why I want them to know everything about me, so that everything I do, every media event I consume is tailored to my particular bizarreness. Wouldn't that be awesome? Everything's personalized, even my insurance policies. Our show today, actually, you know what we do before that? Let's take a look at what you missed this week. We had a fun week, and we've made a little movie all about it. Watch.
Previously on Twit.
Happy 300th, you guys.
Happy 301, everyone.
300, that's why I'm all dressed in my best suit.
7-3 to some of the smartest people I've ever met.
A happy 300th to the chat room and to those that made us where we are today.
All about Android.
Flo and I had the opportunity, and we were super thrilled to do it, to sit down with a few of Android's top executives.
So it's Project Travel. We call that because it's all about the base. It was a huge amount of work. We had to change every single interface at the bottom of Android. We had to separate out all the vendor code to run in a separate process. It's probably the biggest engineering change we've made to Android since we started.
Home Theater Geeks.
In episode 355, I chat with re-recording mixer Mike Minkler about his work on the original Star Wars, which debuted in theaters exactly 40 years ago.
I made a special attempt to make Chewbacca's footsteps big and powerful. And when George heard us and said, "Wookiees don't make footsteps sounds. Take out all of his Foley sound. I don't want to hear it." So you hear everybody else running around, but you never hear a Wookiee footstep.
If you missed Twit this week, you missed a lot.
That's useful trivia.
You'll never. What? 300?
Did I miss last week? I heard it's your 301st episode of Ham Nation. Good job. Ham Nation, that's a fun show. It's amateur radio enthusiasts. And that one's on every Wednesday on our network. Megan Maroney, we've got a big week ahead. What's cooking?
This week, former Android head Andy Rubin will unveil a secret new company that he has been keeping under wraps. Essential will likely announce a bezel-less smartphone. If you want to see a silhouette of the announcement that's set to come on May 30th, take a look at the company's Twitter account, at Essential. BlackBerry's T1 will be available in the U.S. and Canada this week. The phone was supposed to be released last month, but ran into a few snags on the way. And in other smartphone news, the recently announced T-Mobile program Digits launches this week. T-Mobile plans to virtualize its customer phone numbers in a way that makes them accessible across a number of platforms and devices. The new system is free for all T-Mobile users. And really for those who might want more than one number to hand out, they can pay $10 to snag an extra. And finally, this week, Microsoft's Xbox Game Pass officially goes live. If you're a gamer who has always dreamed of having a Netflix-style all-you-can-stream subscription service, this might be as close as you're going to get. We'll see how it works this week. And that's just a few of the things that we will be tracking in the coming week. Join Jason Howell and myself on Tech News Today every weekday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, here on twit.tv.
Subscribe and you'll never miss another tech story. Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. If you're getting a new home, buying a new home, unless you're paying cash, I know you're all very wealthy. You're just going to write a check, right? No, you're going to get a mortgage. Or maybe you would like to get a little money out of your house or lower your interest payment, maybe with a refi. You got to check it out. The best mortgage lender in the country, bar none, Quicken Loans. And they have, look at all those customer satisfaction awards. Number one, year after year. And they have a product just for us geeks. They call it Rocket Mortgage. It's a completely online mortgage approval process. Whether it's buying a new home or refinancing your existing home, you can do it all in minutes. And the last time I bought a house, it took me a month from that big bank down the street. We went on vacation. We were faxing paperwork from a cruise ship. It was crazy. Rocket Mortgage, you can do everything you need online, including submitting the paperwork you need, the pay stubs or the check statements. And you can customize it, customize the term and the rate, and get approved in minutes, not days, not weeks, not months, minutes, for a loan that's just right for you. Now, I know you're probably not buying a house right now, but make a note of this, quickenloans.com/twit2. And when you're ready to buy, you go to Rocket Mortgage. Quickenloans.com/twit2, equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, and MLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. We thank Rocket Mortgage and Quicken Loans for super serving us geeks. Clayton Morris is here from Fox and Friends and MorrisInvest.com. Tim Stevens is here from CNET, theroadshow.com. We've got Dan Patterson in studio, first time ever, from TechRepublic.com. Here's the phone. This is kind of a giveaway. Here's the phone. Andy Rubin, who invented Android and then sold it to Google and ran the Android division for years, left, started running robots, and then left completely to create a new phone company. He's been tweeting secret tweets. Can anyone guess what my colleague Wei is working on? Now, look at that. That's obviously, if you look at it. Whoops. Obviously, 3D camera, right? He said, if you can, I'll give you a signed copy of our first product. And then he tweeted this silhouette. Well, it's obvious, of the new phone. Why would anybody buy a new smartphone? I don't care how sexy and bezel-less it is, with a 360-degree camera off the top. They eliminated antennas just a few years ago. Now they're putting that on?
I'm hoping that that's removable so that you can then put it in your pocket and then leave it in your bag and then forget it somewhere and never see it again. And hopefully it's cheap to replace.
Yeah, because you know what this would mean is an avalanche of really ugly 360-degree pictures.
That's true.
We'll see. I do remember this teaser picture that he put out earlier. Something big is coming. And
I'm excited to see what it is, but I'm a little bit skeptical that the world needs another high-end smartphone.
The companies that have kind of grounded on the rocks of that. HTC pretty much gone. LG, I know they're making beautiful phones, but I got to think they're not doing great. Sony's dropped kind of many of their Xperia phones. They're still going to do the high end, but they're not going to do the mid range. It really is a Samsung and an Apple world, isn't it?
Yeah. And where, and to Tim's point, where do you go from here? What?
Yeah. How can you do anything that makes people go out and buy you?
Yeah. I mean, you can only do so much on this device right now, but maybe to your point earlier, Leo, 5 years from now, we're not going to recognize these, you know, things are going to be totally different, but I don't know. It's hard for me, and I'm not terribly bright, to wrap my brain around what more do I need from a smartphone right now?
Well, as we mentioned, Google and Apple both say we're going to put dedicated chips. You got a CPU, you got a GPU, we're going to put an AIPU or something, some sort of artificial intelligence chip. I don't feel like that's the problem is missing processing power. The problem is
Yeah, we're not missing a problem. There's the market needs have been filled.
Yeah, well, I talk to Siri, and I mostly swear at her because she doesn't seem to understand anything I say. Right. And when she does, she gives me useless information.
And the majority of that's happening in the cloud. I mean, that was the biggest step forward when phones started to really be able to understand what you're talking about is when they stopped doing it on the phone to begin with. You know, and that was back before data networks were anywhere near as good as they are today. So now that we have all that cloud processing at our disposal and a lot more bandwidth than we did, you know, when Siri first came around, yeah, I'm a little bit skeptical that having something like that on the phone is actually going to make this that much better. So you know, maybe 360 photography is that next big thing that'll push the smartphone forward and make this, you know, the phone that everybody has to have. But yeah, I'm a little bit skeptical that that's going to be the thing. I think the fact that they're thinking about that, you know, it's interesting. They're trying something different. We've certainly seen third-party dongles that'll do that for other phones before.
There's two, at least, on the iPhone that work exactly like that. They snap over the iPhone and I don't know how they connect, but they look just like that. So I don't.
Yeah. But maybe this means that they're also going to be trying some other interesting, exciting things.
Well, Google Tango, that was the idea of Tango. And it, up to now has required giant phones that would map the space you're in. I never got that one either. We've already seen the face recognition on Samsung's Galaxy S8 phone cracked. Actually, it was cracked at the event when one of the publications took a picture of himself on his existing phone and showed it to the Samsung Galaxy S8, and it unlocked. Now it turns out the iris recognition system is also hackable. The Chaos Computer Club in Germany, kind of one of the classic hacker
the old
clubs,
ones.
Yeah, the CCC, say, well, it's really simple. We just take a picture, and it doesn't even have to be a very good picture, of your iris with a camera. Here, I'll mute the sound. So you can see he's about 16 feet away, but he has a zoom lens on his point and shoot. Doesn't have to get, look how big, the face isn't even that big.
Well, he's not even a killer DSLR or anything like
that. No, it's just a crappy little point and shoot. He's got a picture. They now print out the picture of the eyeball. They blow it up and print it out. Then, in order to trick the Samsung Galaxy S8, they have to make it look spherical. So they print it out at life size, and then they put a contact lens on top of it to make it look like an eyeball. The contact lens distorts the picture to make it round. You'll see it in just a second. So he's got his iris now registered into that phone, and now he's going to unlock it using he's just proving that he can do it. Now he takes a contact lens. I love the chaos. I just love these guys. The Chaos Computer Club puts it on top of the picture and then uses the picture, holds it up, and boom, the phone's unlocked. That was easy. So just a word of warning. If you're depending on iris recognition, I thought we were told iris recognition was the best of the bunch, better than fingerprint, better than face. No. WannaCry is probably not the end of the line. Excellent article in The Atlantic today from Bruce Schneier, one of my favorite security guys. The Schneier blog is, you know, really great. He talks in this article about the shadow brokers. This is the hacker group that embarrassed the NSA by dumping a lot of exploits onto the internet. That's where WannaCry's magic capability of spreading over your local area net came from the NSA and came from this shadow brokers dump. The shadow brokers now say, oh, we're not done yet. In fact, we're thinking of doing a dump of the month club because apparently they have quite a few more exploits from the NSA, and they don't seem to care much about publicizing them.
If this isn't an argument against stockpiling zero days, I don't know what is.
Well, that's an interesting question, because don't you think that intelligence agencies also want, you know, need hacking tools to...
Yeah, hacking tools are one thing, but stockpiling... We have a story that kind of picks apart the reason, the real nuanced reasons why, coming out on June 1st. But the basics are easy to understand, and that is, if there are zero-day exploits within a system... Hacking tools are something different. You have to give Microsoft and other companies the ability to patch these holes. If you stockpile them, this will happen.
But if
leaks
you,
will happen.
But I mean, I'm playing devil's advocate.
Yeah, please bring
but
it.
But if the NSA and their hackers are working hard and they find, oh, this is great, we can use SMB1 to spread, you know, by the way, they wouldn't do it with encryption, you know, ransomware. They would use it to spread a eavesdropping tool onto all of the computers in the Russian embassy.
Yes.
Wouldn't they want to hold on to that? Why? If they tell Microsoft they can't use it.
And there is solid evidence. You know, we are 6 years now, 7 years past Stuxnet. But there's solid evidence that Stuxnet put the Iranian nuclear program back by at least 3 years, which is what we needed.
That was a hack that ruined their centrifuges, yes. So they couldn't enrich uranium, so they yes. couldn't build a nuke. And that helped us negotiate.
And
with
it targeted Siemens Industrial Control Systems.
SCADAs.
SCADAs. Yeah, right. And so I understand that argument, and I really empathize with people within the agency and within the NSA. However, I don't think any of that excuses stockpiling vulnerabilities that allow massive attacks like this to occur.
You guys agree?
Yeah.
It's a tough one, because I think, look, we all want to
protect. Yeah, it is tough.
We want the intelligence agencies to do their job. We want them to protect us from terrorism. We want them to do espionage as needed to protect us from foreign powers, who are, by the way, without any trepidation, stockpiling and spying on us. I don't think the FSB in Russia is having any debate at all about whether they should reveal these vulnerabilities.
Not a bit.
So don't we? Now, there was, under Obama, back in 2008, something created called the Vulnerabilities Equity Process. And the theory was all the stakeholders come to the table, and they actually had, it was actually quite interesting, a series of questions that they needed to ask about this vulnerability to determine whether the NSA should be allowed to keep it, or the CIA or the FBI, or should be required to turn it over. Let me see if I can find the questions that they ask. This is from EPIC.org, the Electronic Privacy Information Center. They have a lot of information about this VEP. And it's been around, as I said, since 2008. The questions seem completely reasonable. For instance, how much is the vulnerable system, in this case, in WannaCry's case, it would have been Windows, used in the core internet infrastructure, in other critical infrastructure systems, in the U.S. economy, or in national security systems? In other words, what's the danger? Does the vulnerability, if left unpatched, impose significant risk? How much harm could an adversary nation do with, or a criminal group, do with knowledge of this vulnerability? How likely is it we would know if someone else was exploiting it? How badly do we need the intelligence? This is a really important one, the one the NSA is going to argue. How badly do we need the intelligence we think we can get from exploiting the vulnerability? So this is a cost-benefit analysis, right? The benefit would be, well, what do we get? Are there, and this is good too, are there other ways we can get it? Could we, let's say, utilize a vulnerability for a short period and then disclose it? How likely is it that somebody else will discover it? Can it be patched or mitigated? In other words, if we tell Microsoft, can they fix it? The problem is this process, although it exists, doesn't seem to have been used much.
And there is liability that now affects people at tremendous scale. So when you have the agency working 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the vulnerability of intelligence leaks, you can mitigate the damage. If we look at what's happening with IoT and what we expect to see in the next 5 to 10 years, plus all of these really kind of poorly made firmware that's on all these IoT devices, right? Yeah. So the scale of damage.
Well, look at the Mirai bot. Which
precisely.
Yeah.
And because this, if you go to a pedestrian, a normal person on the street, and you say, hey, tell me about the 0 days. What?
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
But there's a point, because the Mirai bot probably wouldn't. It was useful in creating a distributed denial of service botnet, but probably would not have been useful in targeted intelligence gathering.
No.
Which is what the NSA is up to. So if they had discovered Mirai, that one under the vulnerability equities process would have been revealed and fixed. But they might keep something that allows them to say hack your smart TV because, well, we can get at Ambassador Kislyov, we could see what he's up to by spying on him through his Samsung. I'm torn on this one. By the way, there's a move in Congress to make this law. This was just merely an interagency agreement. Well, to do this, there's a move in Congress to actually enshrine this in law. That seems like a good step forward. At least you need a process. You have those questions. Now, we talked about this on Tuesday on Security Now. Steve Gibson poo-pooed the idea of a law. He says, it's not going to make it. NSA is going to come to the table every time saying, no, we need it. Yeah. Okay, thanks, bye.
Right. They're not going to seek a warrant.
No. This is like, look at the FISA court. Even the FISA court looks like a rubber stamp. This would be 10 times worse.
In technology, as we all know, is always constrained by laws.
Yeah, right.
Right. So you can make a law. It's not going to stop the agency from... Right. It doesn't change anything. And it certainly won't stop our adversaries.
Yeah. I'm going to be traveling out of the country. I hope that I will be able to bring my laptop on the plane. Unknown.
Mm. I just got back from Europe, and I was dreading the whole time I was there that they're going to pass this new regulation while I was there.
Yeah.
And yeah, exactly.
I do like what 1Password has done, and I hope others will do this. They've created, 1Password is a very popular password vault, something called travel mode. You indicate on your passwords which ones you want to keep while you're traveling. Everything else will be deleted before you get off the plane. You press the travel mode button.
That's brilliant.
Nobody can really tell you've done that. It doesn't, doesn't magically show that. And then when you get home, you just resync and all your passwords are back.
So I'm going to Ukraine in about a week and a half.
Oh, don't bring any electronics.
Yeah. Right. Well, first of all, Tim, I'm definitely not bringing a laptop. And this our number one concern is phishing of those around us. And the number two concern is what happens to any device I have if and the passwords on it.
Imagine you're coming back from the Ukraine. Customs and Border Patrol are going to be looking at you saying, give me your phone.
Right.
Give me your phone.
And I believe in the work that Customs does. And so I, not the Ukrainian Customs, but the American Customs, I will happily give them my device. But I don't want my passwords there.
Where's my, John, do you know where my steampunk laptop is? I want to show you the laptop I'm going to be
Corey
bringing.
Did Corey build it?
No, actually, I paid a lot of money for it. The guy who used to build these, he built all sorts of steampunk stuff. He passed away. But I thought, somebody in the chat room saying, and I think they're absolutely right, bring the steampunk laptop. That way, if the Border Patrol keeps it, it's like, fine. The only problem with it weighs about 80 pounds.
Yes.
You're going to look out the window as those guys are throwing your bags into the cargo bay.
You're like, I'm not bringing it.
That's what I'm scared about.
What is the chance that this laptop travel ban will happen? Are they just floating this as a balloon, or are they seriously considering? I understand the reason why. We know because Donald Trump told the Russians in the Oval Office, we're worried because we got an Israeli intelligence that there's people are putting bombs in laptops or planning on that. So I understand that. By the way, they must have really thrilled the Israelis when he did that. That would make sense. In fact, I kind of assumed that after all this travel, talking about these bans on laptops, that must be what they got some intelligence that said there's a plan afoot.
I had a feeling
is that
coming.
that
or taking shoes sorry, go ahead, off. It's gonna, oh, I was going to say, I had a feeling this was coming. If we had to take our shoes off, I mean, batteries inside of a laptop. I mean, it, you know, in this age of cyber warfare, what is a terrorist? Some sort of advanced organization like ISIS. We know how savvy they've been, you know, online. What they've been able to do to recruit people. I mean, using laptops was not that far afield for them.
So, is it possible I'm going to be gone June 5th through the 18th at sometime in the middle of my trip? They're going to say, "Oh yeah, by the way, don't bring that. You're going to have to check."
Good luck.
We'd have to put it in checked luggage. It's not like I'd have to give it up. But God, how boring. To be on a 12-hour flight.
And it's not just laptops.
It's everything but your phone.
Even Kindles.
Yeah, you can't bring your Kindle.
Right.
What?
How much?
This is devastating.
How much bomb could you put in a Kindle? This one right down here. It's not. This isn't my steampunk laptop, but I think I might bring this one on the trip because if they keep it.
Do it.
Wouldn't it be funny? Only problem is if they said, this is like a, what is this? Is an old Mac luggable. The only problem is if they said, can you turn that on? I don't think I could. This is a PowerBook 145. Look at that trackball. Man, that was state of the art.
That might have been the first laptop I had.
And the bezel.
Beautiful.
Look at the size of that thing.
You put your stickers, William.
This one they
you know
made,
what?
Made
them... We should all revolt and all bring typewriters on flights with really loud characters.
That's electric.
Ban this.
Yeah. So everyone on the flight is there on their tray tables pounding away.
Oh, man. Tom Hanks has a typewriter app. Have you seen that app?
Yeah. It's called Hanks Writer.
Hanks Writer, H-A-N-X Writer. And it's really loud when you use it on your iPad. They released three new typewriters for it, including a Selectric, which is really good. Unfortunately, I was very disappointed because the Selectric, while it has three different font typeface balls, you know how the Selectrics had those balls? It doesn't have the speechwriter ball, which I really liked. That was really giant text. Very silly app. So you think they're gonna? You think Clayton that with all it's all likelihood they're gonna do this?
I don't know. I just felt like it was only a matter of time. Like this new utopia. Well, I mean, think about it, right? We have to take off our shoes. You asked how much bomb can you really fit in a Kindle? I mean, how much bomb can you really fit in the sole of a shoe?
Well, there was that guy who tried to light his shoes on fire, remember?
Right.
Yeah, you can fit a good bomb in a Kindle.
Whatever his name is.
You can fit a good bomb in a Kindle.
Can you?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you know that?
Well, we're really, in Kindle Cairo.
A Kindle, like a Paperwhite?
Yeah. One of my sources in Cairo, we were teaching encryption to Sudanese guys, and we brought them from different parts of Sudan up to Cairo, and we taught them how to use encryption on a mobile device so they could
I remember
back.
When you were doing that.
Yeah,
that was very cool.
So one of my sources, and this is – I have a story. It's been vetted. Like I'm not making this up, but he was like, I'm so poor – I'm going to either make bombs for ISIS or sell my kidney. And so I'm sitting there with my Marantz interviewing him. And we vetted him through the UN. His story checks out. He was kidnapped when he was young in Sudan and taught how to make bombs and taught how to make very small, very effective bombs that will fit inside electronic devices.
Like C3? What would you use to...
I didn't ask him his tactics. But
actually, though, if you think about it, and this is why I guess if you check it, they're not as worried. If you're sitting in the cabin and you're right next to the wall, you can put that Kindle bomb on the wall. All you have to do is blow a small hole
in the
wall.
Yeah, you just got to depressurize it.
And okay, I take it back. In fact, please don't carry any devices on the plane. Please. I don't want...
Let's buy books and magazines.
A smartphone isn't that big enough? You could make a...
Oh, man.
Yeah. I mean, Galaxy Note 7.
Yes. Don't bring that on the plane.
Don't bring that on the plane. Brilliant.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap this up in a minute. Got a bunch of more stories I want to talk to you guys about. But first, a word from Blue Apron. I made Blue Apron last night. It was the best thing. It was so good. And my mouth waters when I do these ads. It makes me so hungry. Blue Apron, it delivers you, it's the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. They deliver incredible seasonal recipes with fresh, high-quality ingredients to make amazing home-cooked meals. Tonight, we're doing blackened pork. I can't wait. Last night, we made it's from Nashville, a spicy chicken, kind of fried chicken, I made mashed potatoes, and I always, in mashed potatoes, I used to use cream and butter, and they did it with fromage blanc and butter, and it was so good. And then the green beans, I sauteed the green beans up, chopped up a shallot, and then I put, they had a little bottle, it comes with a little bottle of vinegar, put a little vinegar in there, sauteed the green beans, put them in the shallot vinegar mixture. They, oh my God, it was, your mouth, the house smells so good in your mouth, and it took me half an hour. And it's this gourmet meal. And here's the best part. I didn't have to buy one thing. Everything I needed, including a half a cup of milk in this little box. Everything I needed to make this amazing recipe. Now, we have Blue Apron for two. Although, you know, partly that's because our son doesn't like fancy food. And he just wants plain pasta, you know, or rice. But the truth is there's enough in this meal that we can give him some. And he actually really enjoys it sometimes. It's a great way to introduce your kids to new flavors, new tastes. And they have a family plan, which has more kid-friendly ingredients. Look at that. What is that? Chicken schnitzel. Oh, that looks good. With fingerling potatoes. Oh, what is that? Roll back up. I want to see the recipe. And marinated Napa cabbage. That's like coleslaw. Oh, my God. You can make this. And the thing is, once you've done it, they don't repeat recipes more than once a year. So you're not going to get that recipe choice. And you do get to choose. It's all online. You choose what you want in the box. You choose when you want delivery. It's not a subscription. So you get it whenever you feel like it. You see exactly the right ingredients. Everything's fresh, even the meat, the fish, never frozen. It's a refrigerated box. And once you've made it, you now know how to make it. And you can go to the store and you can buy the ingredients. And so it's like a cooking school in a box. In fact, I think that's why they call it Blue Apron. Because if you go to the Cordon Bleu in Paris, the apprentice chefs wear little blue aprons. And I think that's where they got the name. The box has a blue apron on it and everything like that. Look at the recipes. Baked spinach and egg flatbread with sautéed asparagus and lemon aioli. See, that's vegetarian. They have vegetarian meals. They can suit your needs. You never get anything you didn't order. So you totally customize it. There's no weekly commitment. Their freshness guarantee promises every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook or they'll make it right. And if you don't like a recipe, they'll send you another one. Look, go there right now. BlueApron.com/twit. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with your first purchase and free shipping. BlueApron.com/twit. I love it when we get home and the Blue Apron box is on the doorstep. Like I said, black and pork tonight. You're all invited, although I only have enough for two. So you have to, like, fight over it. BlueApron.com/twit. Did you see this article, Tim? Tesla analyst split. Some people think Tesla's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and some people think let me stop Bloomberg right here. They say it comes down to whether you're a tech guy or a car guy.
Right. And me being a tech and a car guy, obviously I think the truth is somewhere in between the two extremes there. I think from a tech perspective, it's pretty easy to overlook a lot of the complexities of developing a car. Just like, you know, I think Tesla and Elon Musk would admit they did exactly that when they were launching their first cars. You know, it took a long time to bring the Model S to market, took a long time to bring the Model X to market. They're learning, they're getting better. But the real question right now in my eye is, can Tesla continue to be quicker at innovating than a company like Volkswagen, like Porsche, like Audi? Can they beat those guys consistently?
They've done very well. I mean, look, they've done great. You can't deny they've done great. And they've ramped up and they're producing the Model 3. And it looks like they're going to get to whatever their goal is per year. What was it, 80,000 vehicles a year? But you're saying, okay, fine. Now here come the big boys.
Right, exactly. And Porsche is investing hundreds of millions of dollars into battery facilities, into the groundwork that they need to make a killer EV. And, you know, that's going to be a really good car when that comes out. And if they can make a car that's better than the Model S, that costs less than the Model S, and from a brand like Porsche, are people really going to continue to support Tesla? Right now, Tesla's got a unique proposition. You know, they make a really fast, really nice looking EV. When everybody has a really nice, really fast looking EV, and you can buy one at any dealership just down the road and have a warranty that you trust and, you know, all the other things that come along with buying from a major manufacturer that you're familiar with, will Tesla continue to have this position? And that's, you know, that I think is the big question. And ultimately, I don't think anybody really knows the answer to that right now.
So, but that's for investors. For people buying a car, would you say, did I make a mistake buying a Tesla?
Well, we talked about this before. I'm a little bit skeptical of the Model X reliability in the long run. But no, I think Tesla makes really great cars. I'm definitely curious.
If those gull wing doors fall, or falcon wing, whatever they call them, fall off, I'll let you know. I'll be the first to tell you.
And it seems like
Tesla makes a car that drives like nothing else on the road right now.
I love my Tesla.
Yeah, it's
and
fantastic.
Once you drive an electric car, you don't really ever want to go back to a gas vehicle, right?
Right.
Yeah, and you can go to... Go ahead, Clayton.
I was going to say, when you can go like 0 to 60 in like 3.5 seconds, you're kind of...
It makes my head hurt, though. I don't do it anymore because it feels like my brain hit the back of my skull. It's like, I don't want to... It hurts.
But with some of the upgrade, what I was going to say about, you know, and they sort of, I don't know if it's sort of an Apple approach. It seems like it is, but sort of an, and Tim, you can speak way more intelligently on this than I can, but the sort of Apple approach to upgrades and fixes and sort of the wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Hey, if you have a problem with this, we just swap everything out. There's a problem with the battery 4 years from now. We just yank it out of the floorboards and put a brand new one in there for you. There's not a lot of moving parts. If we have any problems, we check it once a year. We fix anything.
I know. I haven't brought my car in. There's no oil to change or anything.
Yeah, there's no engine.
Yeah, that's one of the hidden things, one of the hidden values of owning an EV is the lack of maintenance. You know, right. There's really nothing that you have to do about it except replace the, you know, the washer fluid every now and again, rotate your tires, and you're pretty much good to go.
That's about it, yeah. Patreon, what a success story. And now they say, now I think this is probably because they're going to go for either more investment or maybe even an IPO. I don't know. But they say, they put out the word, they now have 1 million paying patrons. 1 million. That's doubled in a year. The number of active creators on Patreon, 50,000. This is the site where, and I actually support a number of podcasts and my Linux distribution that I like. I actually give the guy $5 a month. It really is a great way for creators to get kind of patronized, subsidized by patrons. They are on track to pay out unbelievably $150 million to creators this year. That's just amazing. Now, that doesn't mean they're amazingly profitable because they take a 5% cut. So a little math will tell you that's $7.5 million in revenue for Patreon. So they're kind of a small company. But some congratulations, I think, in order for Patreon and the success of Patreon. It's really kind of impressive.
And the success they enabled. I think this is also one of the blown opportunities of Medium. You know, everybody thought for a while Medium recently launched their subscription program forgetting Yogg's Law. Which way does money flow in publishing? Towards the creator.
Oh, interesting.
Medium wants you to pay them to curate stories that other people have created.
There are bloggers on Patreon, aren't there?
Yeah. Patreon takes a percentage of revenue generated by creators. So this is a huge missed opportunity Medium, right? It's Yogg's Law. It's like all money in publishing should always flow towards a creator. Your agent takes a cut and the publisher takes a cut. But in Medium's case, they wanted us to pay them instead of paying the creator. I'm way more loyal to a writer, to somebody who creates software for a living. I'm way more loyal to those things than I am to some startup that's already well-funded.
By the way, I never heard it before, but I'm in love with Yogg's Law as a creator.
Right.
I think that's a good law. I'd like to make that a law. Robot police in Dubai. Right now, they don't do much except salute and answer questions, but could it be RoboCop? Dubai says that they want 25% of their police force to be robotic by the year 2030. Is this just a gimmick? Hello, citizen.
You can definitely see some limited security roles being easily done by then. You know, if it's just someone on patrol taking a report, monitoring suspects, that kind of thing. That I think is easy enough to do, and that's probably a pretty substantial part of you know, a day-to-day workforce of a security officer. So that kind of thing I think sounds realistic. But ultimately, you know, the idea of like a District 9 style digital soldier walking down the street with a gun on their hip, I think we might be a little further down the road than 2025 to get that.
Go ahead, Clayton.
We all saw Age of Ultron. You know how that goes. You make that mistake. I can see this being like meter maids.
You got to have a kill switch. Kind of if you're going to make a robotic cop, there has to be a plug you can remove. You know, unplug the plug.
Right.
It's just obvious. All you have to do is see RoboCop, and you need a way to unplug the thing. That's all. And we'll wrap up with a farewell to the dean of tech journalism. Walt Mossberg's last column appeared in Recode on May 25th. He's been doing this longer than anybody except me. He started in 1991, right about when I started doing a tech talk radio, although I'd been writing about tech since the late 70s. Long time to be writing, first in the Wall Street Journal, then he left the Journal and started Recode. Here's his first column. And, you know, you could probably, you know, say the same thing again. Personal computers, he wrote, are just too hard to use, and it isn't your fault. The computer industry boasts its products can help everyone be more productive. Maybe so, but many people can't afford the time and money needed to get the most out of PCs. So, Walt, well done. I hope I can retire someday, too. But meantime, we'll stick around and fill the gap left by Walt Mossberg. Hey, you guys are great. Thank you so much for being here. Dan Patterson, you can find more of him at Tech Republic. I think we should just get you on and talk about all the things you learned covering the campaign, the tech angles on the campaign. And we'll look for your writing in Tech Republic about that, too.
Well, it's always wonderful to be here. Leo, you have been, and Twit has been, through thick and thin. I've had a long career, and I've had ups and downs, and Twit has been there consistently.
Mostly thick when it comes to
yes, right, yeah, yeah. I'll join you.
Well, thank you. It's really great to have you, Dan. I really
great
appreciate
to be here.
It. Yeah, yeah. A huge respect to the stuff,
you too.
The stuff you do. Clayton Morris, you'll find him at Morris Invest, one not plural, singular, morrisinvest.com, at Clayton Morris, and of course on Fox and Friends every weekend. Thank you. I'm sure you're tired. You must have gotten up at 4 this morning or 3. When do you get up when you're going to do that show?
Yeah, I got up at 4 this morning, and I've got to get up 4 tomorrow to do the show on Memorial Day.
Did you get a nap or anything?
No, I didn't, because my wife had me grilling. We had a whole bunch of people over for a little Memorial Day thing, so I had to get the grill out, get the yard ready, and all that stuff.
Got to have the barbecue. What'd you grill? Did you do brochettes? Did you do...
We did some burgers. Yeah, did some burgers and corn. Some corn on the grill.
Some nice, sweet New Jersey corn.
Yeah, a little olive oil, a little sea salt wrapped up and on the grill. It was good.
Mm.
And here's some fireworks going behind me now, too.
It's right. Get on out there and enjoy.
They must think it's 4th of July.
Thank you so much, Clayton. Also, thanks to you, Tim Stevens, at theroadshow.com. I actually wish we had more time. There's so many other car stuff I want to talk with you about, but good news. You can follow him at theroadshow.com and get your fill of automotive information. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks for having me, Lou.
Appreciate it. We do Twit every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC. If you want to watch live, and I would love it if you did, you can also join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. And, of course, we have an open studio, so if you want to stop by, we had a nice bunch of people in studio today. It's easy. All you got to do is email tickets at twit.tv. Do that, though, because, as you know, I'm going on vacation. It doesn't mean you can't come. In fact, I think who's filling in for me? Jason Calacanis, which should be interesting. Is Becky Worley filling in?
Jason Snell.
So if you want to come to those shows, you can. But if you email tickets at twit.tv, we know the schedule. We'll let you know who will be here on the days you'd like to be here. But do let us know. Now, if you can't be here in studio or online watching us live at YouTube or Ustream or Twitch or twit.tv/live, you can always get shows on demand. That's what the website's for, twit.tv/thisweekintech for this particular show. But the best thing to do is, however, you know, whatever program you use to listen to podcasts, just search for Twit and subscribe. That way you don't have to think about it. You'll get it automatically every single Sunday night. So you can listen Monday morning. We salute all the men and women who have given their all in service of our country on this Memorial Day weekend. Thank you very much. It's more than barbecues and parades. It really is a chance to remember those people who've given so much to preserve this nation we love so much. Thank you for your service. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for joining us. Another Twit.
This is amazing.
Doing the Twit.